call the Finance Administration meeting to order. We have an agenda before us today, and that agenda item covers several action items and two information items. Are there any questions about the agenda? Hearing none, we will move forward. The first item on the agenda is the minutes of the last Finance Committee meetings, April 8th. Is there a motion to accept the April 8th minutes?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Any questions? Hearing none, and those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Is there a motion for the April 22nd?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And for April 29th?
So moved.
Second?
Is there a second?
Okay.
Second.
All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye and opposed. Okay, we're past that. The next item on the agenda is the Financial Systems Integration System, and this one is a moving forward on one of the major technology pieces in the authority. And Ms. Carroll, you will begin.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to have Stephanie Audette take you through this presentation. Stephanie Audette is the controller for the authority. She is actually chairing the project. That is a very critical piece for us to move forward on for this year in light of the fact that we're looking to provide more management, oversight, transparency, and accountability for not only our operating but our capital budgets. This project will actually cap that off for us in order to move forward into the next several years as we look into investing in the steady state of good repair for the authority. So I would just ask, Stephanie will take you through this this presentation, and we're asking as an action item for the committee to approve that, which will come to the board on May 27th. So, Stephanie.
Good morning. I'll try to move through this very quickly, and of course, any questions that you have, please feel free to ask me. Again, I am the controller of the authority, and this is a very exciting project to me, so also keep me online, if you would, because I think it really is going to make our ability to provide service much better. So this is, again, the what we're asking for today is the approval to initiate and award contracts to implement the financial system integration project for better integration and optimization of current applications, a mouthful. I just wanted to give you a little bit of history. We implemented the PeopleSoft Enterprise system, and that's not just specific to our financial system. It's our supply chain, our financial systems, our human resource systems. We also implemented separately Maximo in order to take care of our maintenance and material management, and implemented Trapeze for our scheduling. This project relates to the PeopleSoft for financials, EPM, HR, CRM item. And after the implementation in 2005, we have worked with and lived with these systems for a number, obviously for 5 years. And right now, what we've determined is we really need to upgrade and better integrate the systems that we have. So we determined the systems are fine, but they, based on an assessment that was just concluded, that they need a little bit of work. Next slide, please. The apologize, very difficult to read. In the green box, we have just completed, as I had said, in February, an assessment of the, I'll call it procurement and financial side of our systems. We have broken it in two because we have, although we have the full enterprise system, we can only bite off so much of it. So we first looked at financial and procurement. We're currently undergoing an assessment of our HCM, or human resource systems. They're all under the same steering committee, all under the same umbrella. There's a focus that they absolutely need to be lined up and moving in tandem, but we're trying to parse them out in steps that we can take and can plan and to manage in the right fashion. So as of in the first block there is just we have assessed our current state from a procurement finance point of view. Based on that, our next step in this is, and why we're here in front of you, is to ask for the funding in order to implement the roadmap that we determined from our assessment. And then the next step in the blue, which is difficult to read, is to actually
have this implemented on July 1st, 2011 and be utilizing this system. Just to give context again, because I want to make sure we do have the full picture in front of us, our PeopleSoft system have all of these components, and the main components that we're looking at right now are financials, and that's what we're looking to implement, which again includes our procurement side and includes our, obviously, our general ledger, payables, receivables, the financial side. We also are currently doing an assessment, but that's separate from this request, of our human capital system. Again, same steering committee, same officers, and just moving them in tandem. As a result of the assessment we just completed of financial procurement, we determined we had some good lights, which were that as far as technical capabilities, we have shored up our hardware, our infrastructure, change management procedures are good. Our disaster recovery procedures need some improvement, and then the rest of it is really the areas that we found that we need the biggest change, or that highlighted what we need to do. On automation, we're just, although we're in control and our data is okay and our data is auditable, we have it's too manually intensive. We have to touch it too often, which leads you to some ability to have error that in turn you have to catch and review and correct. Along all of our automation data value integration, we're just not lined up. The system isn't set so that the pieces of an enterprise system talk to each other. My simple concept of an enterprise system is I put the data in once in one area, and then I never have to touch it again because I've got it set up and organized, and it will report out and flow through correctly with the right controls. We're not integrated in that fashion. Each of our pieces work, but they don't talk. And some of our pieces need a little bit of rebuild. So that's basically what the assessment told us. The assessment also told us, next slide please, that we have some challenges we're facing in order to do this and do it right. And one of the challenges is that we have constant reorganization, and that reorganization also flows and is constantly reflected in our financial results or the way we organize our data. I guess that doesn't fit a best practice. We really should plan our reorganizations so that we make sure we have consistent processes, consistent reporting, consistent information. We focus on technical management. We blame a system. We say the PeopleSoft system, which is our enterprise one, doesn't work, and that's not valid. What happened is we didn't focus initially, and that's what we are focusing on in this implementation, also on process, both integration, that the system talks across board, but also that our processes, business processes, my accounting, my transactional, line up with that system. So it's important that we focus both on the process and the system at the same time. We've had severe issues with data that we manage by manual correction and manual review and manual touch, and we should have standards, one source, going in once. We have a complex budgeting and cost tracking system, the way our system is built, that really, again, with that single touch and inputting the information once in the right categorization and definition, can flow through and enforce the right accountability. We have significant workflow and data issues. We need clear responsibility, and that goes to process. We all need to know what our role is, what we should be doing with the data, how it fits in the full picture. And again, we're very highly manual, inconsistent, both in procurement and payables. And so we really need a simplification and automation, a defined, repeatable processes. So it's not rocket science, but it's very simple, but it's hard to implement across an organization. As a result of this assessment, we had a series of requirements or deliverables, all of which were met where they're very, and they are now providing us with a roadmap forward. Effectively, the assessment was set up to say, what do we look like today? What are our requirements? And then what should we look like? And then how do we get there? So I refer to it as a roadmap forward. That roadmap forward basically indicates that we need both to bring in the right implementer, and I'll talk to that on the next slide, but we also need to set up the right organization to effect this change. So this organization that you see here says that you need a cross-functional executive leadership that supports the project. And we have had that, and I thank both Dave and Carol very much for that. They're both on our steering committee, and will be consistently throughout this project. The officers underneath them are also cross-functional. I'm the finance officer. We have a technology officer, we have a human resource officer, and we have an operations officer. So we've reflected that throughout all of our teams in the assessment, all of our analysis, all of our understanding of where we need to go, and all of that information is brought into our roadmap. So we're making sure that this product serves the authority, doesn't just serve my general ledger or my need to report. So. And the other, obviously, requirements for success. We need the consistent executive leadership. We've got it. We need the cross-functional teams. We have it. We've got our project is based on IT governance methodology. And I know the Inspector General has reviewed past projects, has given us solid advice. We're following that advice. And it is very important that we do have this set up so that it's established right, it's managed right, it has the right oversight. So we recognize that, and we've been following that. And that we need a dedicated project team, which we are building right now. In regard to the implementer, we are following, we're following all the procurement guidelines and the right guidelines, but I just wanted to emphasize that we need an implementer in place quickly because we would like to roll this out on July 1st, 2011. For the accounting changes that we're making and the transactional changes, it's best to do it on the start of a fiscal year. We want a contractor who really has a proven record of success in PeopleSoft re-architecture. Sometimes people refer to it as troubled PeopleSoft implementations, and just troubled in that they don't speak across. You're not using your system or getting the efficiencies. And so we really want to make sure that they have the right references. They've done this. They've worked with governments. They know how to do it. That idea of a plus is the knowledge of metro culture and challenges, or transit culture and challenges, or government culture and challenges, because that's all us. And that it be fixed price, milestone-based contract structure. So, in conclusion, what our request is, again, we've done our assessment, we have our roadmap, that's completed, we have a clear vision ahead, and we're asking for the full funding for this project is really in two sources. One is we have the ARRA $5 million funds that were given to us to start this project, to start the assessment, to move ahead. In addition to that, based on the assessment and based on estimates of what we think we will need, we're asking for some additional contract authority in order to use some of our Metro Matters funding that also was assigned to a PeopleSoft system and to utilize it for this project. So we're looking at a total project cost for the financial systems portion of it for this year of $12 million. This $12 million also does include $3 million that is going to be for Metro staff in order to support this project, learn it, get the training, and be able to divest ourselves as a consultant quickly after we complete the implementation, and the $9 million is for outside contracts we would need to implement.
Okay, thank you very much. I just have one question, and that you referenced this earlier, and that the auditor had looked at the auditor had looked at this and given some recommendations.
Yes,
and that has you have responded to those all of her items as were presented, and you are comfortable with moving forward under this structure at this time?
Oh, absolutely, if I could respond to that. I've read in depth the OIG report, and I find that the guidance is very helpful, and basically what I've done is I won't bother you with that, but if I can go into further detail at any time you want, that they had certain concerns with the way the previous projects had been managed, some related to the methodology, some related to the ability to manage the contracts or focus on cost-effective approach, some related to no master plan, insufficient oversight. And what I've done is made sure I've recognized them, and we've lined out this project so that every single one of those concerns are answered, that we're very comfortable that we are set up to succeed.
I might add one of the things that we are doing in order to make sure that we are continuing, as we go through this 12-month process, we've actually invited the Inspector General to participate in the steering committee meetings on a biweekly basis. as a silent observer so that we make sure that we're engaging them up front versus having that done at the end of the game. So I think that's a good practice, standard practice, that we're engaging in.
Mr. McKay.
Just a clarification on that and then a question. First, the Inspector General will be involved in the process as a silent observer is what I just heard, but will they issue an audit as we go through this process of where we stand and how it's being implemented? Because I, you know, it was put politely that they had certain concerns last time. Mm-hmm. I would characterize it as significant, legitimate concerns that seem pretty fundamental in the IT business, to me at least. And so what I'd like to do is first get a commitment that they're not just going to be a silent observer, but they will be reporting back to the board in the form of reports as to how this is being implemented so we don't repeat. So the board is comfortable and knows we're not repeating some of the past mistakes. Is that your understanding of their role in this?
Actually, the board directs, as you know, the activity of the OIG, and I'm sure that the OIG would do that. We've actually, our process is open. So we would embrace that, but that direction would have to be given by the committee.
Okay. Well, when it's time to
make the IG.
When it's time to make a motion, I would suggest that we make that as a part of the motion. I think it's critical, given the past performance and report, that the IG have a play a more vital role in making sure this works. My question is the $3 million for the Metro Staffed Project Organization. If I look at the chart on page 15, is that $3 million the HCM lead, financials lead, technical lead, and organization optimization lead? Are those, is that where that money is, and are those new positions that are not already in existence at the authority?
It's those positions, but also underneath where that chart cuts it off is there. It's a group of 20, because under each of those, the HCM lead would have four. Each of them has four to five team members underneath them that are monitoring a part of the process. So for example, the financial, obviously I know the best. I have to make sure that one of those leads is following the procure to pay, following the check to rec, whatever, rec to check, I guess, process. So there are people underneath there. So it's an organization of 20. Some of them, some of them are currently with the organization and will be moved into those positions. Some of them will be hired from outside. So some of them will be new positions.
I think the 20 people, and I'll answer this, most of the 20 people we're looking to get the subject matter experts internally, right, because they're the people who are actually doing the work. They're the people who have to be retrained. They're the people who have to do it when the consultants and the integration is done. So our first priority is doing that. There's selection panels that are happening currently that are interviewing those people, and kudos to them for stepping up to doing double duty for a year. And actually, we have a lot of people who are interested in doing this because it goes to career development, as well as retraining, as well as, you know, new systems for the future. So that being said, where we don't have the subject matter expert in-house, we have to go outside. I would suspect, and I'm saying this about out of the 20 people, we would probably maybe only engage one or two people from the outside if we don't have those subject matter experts. So in answer to your question, those one or two people who we engage on outside would be new headcount that would be charged to the capital project, and once the capital project, that money goes away, if you will, those positions would go away, and that's how it would be charged, not cooperating.
Yeah, I understand that. I guess the concern I have is the $3 million. I don't understand how we're spending $3 million on Metro staffing at this if it's that there's one, you know, expert that may be coming in, or two positions. And what I'm trying to figure out is how we get from using our existing staff by and large for this to a $3 million expense for Metro staffing and project organization. Maybe you can elaborate on how we get to that figure.
Well, it's not new money. It's really just a project budget. So if I'm paying someone now,
so you're charging them to a different account, basically.
Right. It's charging them to a different account. That's really all we're doing. Yes. That salary is currently we have that salary now. It's just now being charged to a specific project.
Okay.
Any other questions? Mr. Dally and then Mr.
Just to follow up on that, you also will be in parallel continuing to maintain the existing systems.
That's right.
While you're building a new one, so.
Definitely. Yes.
Mr. Bender.
I'd like to follow up on exactly what we are approving. It's sort of along that same line of questioning. Mm-hmm. We are approving the ARRA funds and the FY10 Metro Matters funds, which will fund these people through 11 and perhaps beyond. Is that right?
Well, let me make a distinction. On the ARRA funds, I believe that the board has already provided the authority to the general manager to award contracts under that. So.
But that's one of the funding sources for the $9 million that you're
yes.
talking about.
That's
and
correct.
These people are going to be part of the overall budget. Mm-hmm. There is a note on the action summary that says additional funding for this project is included in the proposed FY 2011 capital program, mm-hmm. and then says that's subject to board approval. How much more is it that you're going to ask us for in the future, or are we approving some of that now?
You're right now, we are asking that you approve the amount that we need for the contracts. So that's a combination of the ARRA funds, the 4.7, which are already approved, and $4.3 million of Metro Matters approving to go to contract. The $3 million that we talked about in regard to staffing, that would be in the FY11 budget that you would be, it would be approved in that budget.
So it would be part of the capital budget. So you're saying no more contracts, it's just
right.
the staffing, so long as that staffing is necessary and is covered by the capital budget.
Yes. Right.
And presumably, as soon as the development is over, those people would no longer be in the capital budget. I think that's what I heard Ms. Kissel say.
Yes, to the extent that the specific project is over, then we're back to a steady state, you know, baseline, and it would be charged back.
At this point, we're approving contracts, only contracts, and this reference is to staffing in the future. Is that right? The reference to FY11 and beyond.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes, it is. And the only clarification I would like to make, if I could, is when we had gone to that, the vision of what our enterprise system looks like, or that slide, this is looking at the finance and procurement side of it. We currently are having our HCM, which is our people and our recruiting and our training and all of that, the enterprise system that supports all of those, that functionality assessed. Once we've completed that assessment, we'll get a similar roadmap, and at that point we would look to say, yes, that roadmap makes sense, and look for the ability to move forward.
So my understanding is, and I hope we're all common on this, that we are at this point approving part of a much larger set of activities, but that activity is a whole activity, and you're not going to come back to us in a year and say, well, but you already started it, now you got to finish it. This is it.
For the financial portion.
For the financial portion.
For the financial portion.
Yes.
With other portions yet to come, and we know that. Okay.
Is there a motion?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I move approval of the item with the additional motion that we direct the Office of the Inspector General to be involved in this process, to audit this process, and report back to the board as we reach various milestones of how the implementation is occurring.
Second.
Second. Discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much. This is a very important milestone for us. We could tell by the questions we asked in trying to get data back. The next item is an action item, and it's the operating budget. And the action that we're moving to accomplish today is to give final direction to staff on the fair part of the operating budget. There are many moving parts in this budget, and it has been a difficult budget, but I think we are the mindset that if we can get the fair revenue piece solidified, all will be subject to board approval. This moves this from the Finance Committee to the board, but it also gives the final direction to the staff as to what their role will be in putting together the fair impact. And yes.
I just wanted to ask a question.
Yes, you may.
Could we get a sense of the roadmap ahead in terms of this interim action, when the board might or might not deal with the broad budget, or when does it all close out? Having been through this before.
Okay. Let me tell you. We have a set of milestone dates that we've been attempting to follow, and I think it provides us on the next board meeting to address our progress in terms of marking where we are mm-hmm. on the entire budget after having had the fair end piece approved,
yes.
and then to approve the budget for final approval in June.
That's correct, yes.
So would we vote on this in the board, or would we, in May, or would we wait until June?
The fair is simply the ability to not become continuously be flexible on the fair, and I think we agreed that we wanted to approve the fair, and that would be the May.
The May board meeting.
Right.
So this committee action would be a recommendation to the board for 2 weeks from now.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Followed by a final effort on the budget.
Right. Mrs. Zimmerman has a question.
So you'd be sending the fair increase to the board today, which would go in 2 weeks to the
board.
That's
correct.
And you would be sending nothing else about what the budget's going to look like or any other components of the budget.
And it's open for discussion today regarding other elements of the board, because what we want to do is simply update us. I would guide us in saying that since we're going to the board on the 27th, then anything that we wish to do about that we can do with agreement having been reached on the budget part. But what we have is a framework now that has been guided by the revenue on both the fair as well as the subsidy, and I think when we move into our discussion, you will hear some of that. But I think I think we need to leave the window open as to the final approval of the budget.
I'm just trying to get clear. The intention is that your committee would today make the decision about the fair.
Right.
You will not have made a decision about service, about subsidy, about capital, or any of that. It will make the decision on the fair, including how much of the budget will be fair increase. And then the board will have to do likewise in May. But the board would not be making a decision on the other things until June.
Well, I think I will leave that for the board discussion, but I will tell you I think it is a good recommendation to mark that budget in May as to where we want it to be in June. Otherwise, we will delay our approval process in June.
Okay, in which case then you'd need the whole budget to be going for the May meeting. So when would the committee be sending the other recommendations on the budget to the board?
I think some of that discussion can be observed today and determine whether or not we're prepared to make that.
Do you anticipate taking a vote on any of those other elements today?
No.
So when might the committee be taking such a vote prior to a board meeting?
Well, I think I cannot speak for all the committee members, but I think that can be after you see the discussion today, and if we can move into it, you have in your board book a full budget update based on the fairs, and it will tell us where. There's no blue sheet that represents.
No, I don't think that's there.
I'm sorry. You're talking about the fair table.
We have fair table.
We have the
Do
two
we
fair
not
tables.
Have
we have the two fair tables.
Gap closing. We don't have the gap closing sheet.
No, but I can have that this morning. We didn't put it in the presentation.
Well, I'm sorry. It came to everyone.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
It wasn't in the mail.
It was in the mail.
In the email.
Okay. I guess if you didn't click, you didn't get it.
Madam Chair, I'm not going to go into this at length because I previously expressed my point of view on this. I appreciate your aspiration concerning the guidance on the fare increase, and I appreciate why you want to do it this way. But we have never previously done it this way. We have never voted on a fare direction without knowing the other pieces of this budget. And I am very uncomfortable. I don't know how exactly uncomfortable. I don't know whether I'm going to vote against this or not. But I'm very uncomfortable with having a direction on fares without knowing what's going to happen to service reductions, what's going to happen to jurisdictional subsidies, and what's going and the other parts of this budget. I think that we have got to work to consider this as a totality. Let me add that the DC Council, we still have a month left in our budget process. My committee marks up the Metro WMATA budget at 6 o'clock today. And so I am not by any means finished with our endeavors in terms of finding additional funds, hopefully, to reduce the fare increases, to eliminate service reductions. And so I'm very uneasy, even though I understand we're going to, there's revenues at stake, and perhaps when we get into the discussion of this, we can really drill down as to see just exactly how much revenue is at stake. But in the past, for very good reason, we have always viewed this budget as a whole. And I just have to express once again my uneasiness with a different approach.
Thank you.
Even though I understand what you're trying to do and why you're motivated to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Downey.
I share the same view that nothing really can be decided till everything is decided. They do hang together. I understand the staff's concern that they get enough direction about the nature of the fare increase in order to get work underway to be able to implement it timely. But it strikes me, for example, and I'm not saying I'm for or against peak of the peak fares or some of these others, but the bulk of the work is to put the system in place.
Yes.
The last piece of action is to dial up exactly how much that is. And I think if we can sort of generally say this is the direction the fare increase will have to go, you get that time without having to absolutely lock in the last number. Mm-hmm. Is that sensible?
That's basically correct. I think the pieces
we can't
that
come out of left field with some totally new idea on June 25th and say, have a bake sale. But we can say, here's generally the way we're going. It gives enough latitude, I think, to begin an implementation.
Okay. Can we begin the presentation? Are there any other questions before we begin? Okay. Ms. Kissel.
Okay, so based on the last meeting, we just wanted to update the board on the direction that was given, and then provide some analysis that we had done at the request of the committee. In the general manager's proposed budget, again, we had the $89 million of fare increases. General manager Richard Sarles recommended a gap closing measure and brought it before the committee. That had an increase of that fare increase at $102.8 million. At the 29th FA committee, staff was directed to take some additional actions. And on the next page that you have, we looked at the additional 10 cents to add 20 cents to peak of the peak. In the presentation that we gave 2 weeks ago, as a reminder, we had assumed that 10 cents for peak of the peak would generate $5 million in additional revenue. The committee asked us to look at an additional 10 cents. We had estimated that at the time because we had not done the analysis that would be probably another $5 million. After doing some other analysis, which we'll talk about later, we actually view that the first 10 cents from peak of the peak is near the $5 million, but it'll probably be about $4.5 million. And the second 10 cents after some analysis that we had done is really only going to generate $3.2 million. We actually took direction from the committee. We removed the 50-cent parking increase that was on the remaining late-night service. We added that back. We removed the $4 flat fare, and then we charged the peak of the peak on late nights from 12 a.m., and we looked at those types of changes. Before I get through what some of the analysis is that we did, I'm looking at some of the additional peak of the peak on the congested core and things like that. I just actually wanted to remind the committee that of what our fare policy and principles are, which we have presented in the past. And here you can see many of the fare policies that we're taking, all of them comply with the current guiding principles that we have set forward and that the board has adopted. So rail fares based on distance traveled, we're compliant with that. We charge, trying to look for charging more for premium service, maximizing the existing capacity, facilitating the transfer between bus and rail. We're continuing those particular discounts between rail and bus and rail, providing discounted fares for obviously continuing that for some of our riders and collecting revenue in a cost-effective manner, as is apparent by the fact that we're trying to charge a surcharge for paper fare cards, and that was part of our fare recommendation, and slowing the growth for Metro Access. charging twice the Metro service fare for extra access users. So that's just a reminder of what those policies are for the board to consider.
Can I just ask a factual question?
Sure.
We're going back to the prior page. This is just a factual question. My recollection of the discussion that we had at the last committee meeting was that I requested an increase in the maximum fare by 15%, just like other rail fares. I know that Mr. Benjamin disagreed by saying it wasn't necessary. I think it's becoming increasingly apparent that it is necessary, and I don't know how that got dropped, just completely out, because you had two people comment. And
I apologize. I did not have that in my notes. We did not look at that. So let me just be clear. Look at increasing the max fare by only 15%. Okay.
Well, it's only 11.
It's only 11 now. Increasing it to 15%.
Okay. So would you repeat what you're asking to have?
Well, I mean, this is factual. I'm not getting into
the
differences or agreements. But this was an issue I raised the last time, and in the recap, it just wasn't there. So I just wanted it
to
be part of the. And we had on the 50-cent parking increase, I don't think we agreed to remove it. We agreed to consider this. And I, with Mr. McKay, you know, I said I evidenced a willingness to figure out how to do it. But to say this is now removed is not quite accurate either.
Mm-hmm.
See, because we've had these things are very much in play at this point, and I think I just want this sheet to accurately reflect my recollection, and maybe others have other recollections as to what was
just,
going
just
on.
Just a comment on that. You're right. You did ask the 15%, and
I can't hear you.
You did ask for the 15%. That's going to be corrected. Right. We started this out by saying we're asking to consider. We were asked you wanted to further consider these items, and they're not fait accompli, if you will.
For some reason, I can't hear you. Can you?
Sorry about that. The list of items here are not fait accompli. In the introduction, we say this is to further consider these items.
Right. But it talks about the committee's direction and so forth. This is presented as what the committee was, you know, and this does not reflect my recollection of what we considered. We didn't decide any of this. You know, I know we haven't had a vote, but I'd like at least to have these things on the table.
I think that is, if I'm not mistaken, I think that's what the staff is trying to reflect those items, and you appear to be correct that your question was not included here. We go back and then look at the final, then we will see that they were. I think the committee said the list at the end of the meeting as to what staff should then include, and that was what we gave directions to. You want to go back to the minutes?
Yeah, it's in the minutes.
Yeah,
sorry.
It's in the minutes.
From April 29th, we this was the direction, and the minutes do emphasize that it is just this direction and that it's subject to change.
Right.
Okay.
Table reflects it as if it was decision.
I beg your pardon?
The tables that are produced essentially reflect those as decisions. I think Mr. Graham is correct in that because things that were removed, that say they're removed there, are off the table.
But we asked us.
Well, there's another iteration of that table. You're correct. That's what you see today. Because that's the only way if they're going to be considered but not put anywhere within the budget, we have no idea what the effect is. And that's what it does do. Now, does that mean some of you have a terrible echo? Does that mean that somebody puts something else back or whatever? That's sort of where we are today. But without doing that, this does not affect.
Let me clarify, Madam Chairman. If we look at page 43 where it says fair table, where would I see the parking fee on the table?
The parking fee has been removed.
Page 43.
So there was no committee direction. There was no committee vote.
There's two fair tables, I believe. The first fair table.
Yeah.
There's one fare table. It says fare table. It's the first one. Under other increases, it says raise all parking fees by 50 cents. It has 6.5 million.
So and the if second that were included, that tells us how much it would be.
Yeah, we provided both. We provided
and,
that.
And your total, running total of whatever the number is now, and I, you know, we've been seeing different numbers, and I saw something different last night that was sent. I don't know if this is the same one that was sent out last night or the day before. But the running total includes that revenue?
On this table, that's correct. It does.
Well, the number that, again, I don't know which table is the one the committee is actually working from, but the one I saw last night,
there's another.
Chairman, was that? That, was, that didn't right. come up to 102. That came up to 90-something.
Right. There's another table in the package. Mm-hmm. It says fair table reflecting committee direction.
Mm-hmm. Ah, okay.
And then that table removes the 6.5 and shows the total impact with that. And I apologize, Mr. Graham, for reflecting it in the PowerPoint, but we're trying to reflect it as something to consider, not a direction.
I think the presentation will get us to that, and I think the only maybe concern is that because we did not take an action, something appears as stated, but I think it is a restatement as what was in and what was taken out and when it was what the effect was in the overall. Mm-hmm. That's why I asked that we get this back so that we could see what that looks like on the overall budget.
I have copies of that if you would like me to distribute it.
Please.
Okay. I think that would help.
Moving on, we can go to the peak of the peak. The one slide before that. Slide before that. There you go. Okay. We had done some internal analysis on what the committee direction request was about peak of the peak and the congested core, looking at different scenarios. I have Tom Harrington here who will take you through the next couple of pages to describe the basis of that analysis and what the outcome was. So.
Thank you. All right, just in terms of why we would look at peak of the peak, I think what we did differently this time versus the analysis you may have seen in the last meeting was we looked at some new directional-based peak pricing. Why we would do it is charging riders in the periods of peak demand. One reason is to reduce congestion. Obviously, these are the most crowded periods in the system. Second is obviously to generate extra fare revenue. But again, recognizing that the peak service we provide is some of the most costly service we provide, so linking the revenue to when the expenses happen. And then third is applying pricing in a way that spreads out loads during the peak and impacts as few riders who are traveling in the off-peak direction. So we want to charge the riders who are going in where the areas are crowded, but we don't want to charge people who are reverse commuting or in parts of the system with capacity. Okay, next. Just to review.
Madam Chair, can we get a sound system check? Is somebody checking the sound system? This is going to be hard for the balance of this meeting.
I agree. We are getting an echo, and hopefully staff can tell us.
Can somebody look into this?
Get something with it. It's echoing in all the mics.
This slide provides an overview of peak, basically time of the trip making in the system. We looked at the same hour and a half that were in the docket, 7:30 a.m. to 9 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. to 6 p.m. These peaks of the peak carry basically half of our entire peak period. Each one carries 17% of daily boarding, so together they're about over a third of our daily ridership is in these peaks of the peak. So we do, on a typical weekday, have very peaked service or ridership. Again, riders in the peak 1 hour will likely pay the surcharge, while those that are right on the shoulders of the peak may shift their time. So that's one other aspect that we looked at in the analysis. And just to contrast, the next slide shows weekend ridership. And again, you can see on a weekend, we're very flat. And this charge would not apply to the weekend, but we're just showing this more for comparison's sake. Okay, next slide. We looked at four options. Two of them were ones that were already discussed. One is applying 10 cents to all stations for the peak hour and a half in the morning, peak hour and a half in the evening. Option two would be charging 20 cents for all stations in those time periods. Option three is one where we're looking at it based on, are you getting out at a core station? So the surcharge would be applied for people that exit these stations in the morning or enter in the evening. It affects 21 stations. 17 of them are selected because they're the highest morning exits. So we know that these are very peak stations in the morning. And then the other four were added more for system continuity.
Just a question. Explain what that means. What do you mean the other four were added for system continuity?
Well, in the case of Arlington Cemetery, if we're charging on either side of it, we know the folks who get off that station are going to travel through a congested link. So the same with Pentagon and Pentagon City and Crystal City. Crystal City came out as a very peaked station. Surprisingly, Pentagon did not, in terms of overall morning exits. Interestingly, Pentagon is a higher boarding station in the morning. More bus riders get off at the Pentagon, get on there. So, but in terms of system continuity, with Crystal City clearly peaked and with the peak load point in that direction, that was how it was selected. I will say that the selecting of the cordon is a little bit of an art, and we've tried to use some rational principles, but I think you could probably question some of the specifics. But I think here we were trying to come up with basically the stations that have the highest ridership. And then the next option, to contrast it, we're looking at basically riders who pass through a maximum load ridership point. So we're doing it based more on the segments. So as a result, the list of stations gets smaller. But the way this would be applied would be all trips that either go to or through the core. So even if you don't actually get off in the core, if you're on a train that passes through the core, you would be charged. So that's how it differs. And so it gets a little bit smaller in terms of the stations. However, we're actually affecting more riders because we do pick up people that pass through this area. And just kind of a quick summary of some of the main assumptions. The ridership growth is consistent with the budget ridership projection of 2%. We looked at revenue based on 11 months with the assumption that this would take longer to implement, so August 1st sort of implementation date. This is the actual surcharge in our minds could be applied at the entry point. So in other words, if you get on the system between 7:30 a.m. and 9 a.m., you would be charged. And then, again, a key aspect of what we looked at was people shifting time, not just shifting mode. So we did look at people who would actually shift from rail to, say, driving. But a particular focus was on people who actually would say, you know, I'm right within 15 minutes of that 7:30 a.m. or 9 a.m. I may just shift my time and go a little bit earlier, a little bit later to try to avoid the charge. And so that's what these percentages show. At 10 cents, we think a very small percent, about 5%, would actually shift time. 20 cents, 10%, and a 50-cent charge, we thought at least about a third of those people would actually shift their time to avoid the charge.
I'm sure.
Yes, Mr. Downey.
Wouldn't some people also shift their station?
Yes.
They have a choice between one where they're
particularly,
paying
where, yeah, right at the, where it's close, sure. And we did also apply our normal ridership elasticities as well, just to account for the percent who actually would leave Metrorail because they're just saying it's too expensive. So that's factored in as well. So here we have the four options arrayed, and you can see basically the revenue and ridership impacts. Looking at annual revenue gain, as was said before, the 10 cents is a little under 5 million. At 20 cents for all stations, it's 7.7 million. And these numbers do include looking at time shift as well for those periods, for options one and two. In options three and four, we're showing both the 20 cent and 50 cents. For option three, it's 5 million at 20 cents and about 7 million at 50 cents that could be generated. And then for option four, where you're actually affecting more of the peak of the peak riders, it's 7 million for 20 cents and 10 million for 50 cents. The line below it gives you a sense of how many people are affected. So when we charge everyone who travels in that peak hour and a half, morning and afternoon, we're saying it's 57 million. If we just charge people that exited those peak stations, it's 37.4 million of those riders that are affected. And then if we charge going through, it's 50 million. So almost 90% of the peak of the peak would be picked up if we do the to and through option. Okay, and the last slide here on the peak of the peak really sort of lays out pros and cons for each of them. Options one and two, where we charge all, From Metro's perspective, a positive is it's easy to implement the fare table, or easier to implement the fare table because we're charging across the board. It does have a lower ridership impact, primarily because we're talking about lower fare increases that we're talking about, and that we capture revenue from all riders across the system, which is one of our objectives, to generate revenue. From the rider's perspective, options 1 and 2 are the easiest to understand. They just know it's a straight 10 or 20 cents across the board. A negative is that it impacts reverse commuting. So if you're traveling in a part of the system that's not crowded, you're still being charged that peak. Option 3, where we're charging people who go to the congested core, from our perspective, a positive, it helps reduce congestion. So that's definitely something that we would like to achieve. And a minus from our perspective is capturing revenue from the riders only to the core station. So even if you're on a train that's very crowded and you're contributing to the crowding, but you pass through the core, you're not charged. From the rider's perspective, again, reducing crowding is a positive. Does not impact the reverse commute is a positive. But I think in terms of public acceptance, I think we'll have to see if this can be communicated in terms of linking it to the service we provide in the peak. And with option 4, it's similar in terms of the positives from Metro's perspective, but I think that the added benefit is that we're getting both the people that go to this core, but also the ones who pass through. And I think for both 3 and 4, the difficulty of understanding is going to be a key issue. We're going to want to make sure that we can communicate the charge in a way that people understand.
Mr. Zimmerman.
Harrington, the slide you had started with talking about the reasons for doing this, 2 of the 3 basically have to do with managing the congestion and spreading out loads, kind of reducing the peaking. And I look at the chart that is on page 33, and I wonder if we're not matching our peak generally and our definition here of peak of the peak to that objective as well as we might. As it is, our peak in the current tariff ends at 9. So we, as it happens, we already have actually a skewed peak. I mean, our regular peak, we haven't discussed this, but it occurs to me that our current peak actually doesn't match what the ridership pattern is according to the data, which I think is something to note and perhaps something to think about. But in the attempt to put a 90-minute period in here matching the data, you have something that's basically slid to the end of the morning rush hour. So, you know, that got me thinking. And then when I looked at kind of where the bars were, the numbers, I wondered if we wouldn't be better if it was actually a little tighter, perhaps with a higher rate than we talked about, but and for a narrower period of time if you're actually trying to shift so that, you know, it's really a spike in an hour and you really want to move people off, then you might better accomplish that by focusing it a little tighter and perhaps having this peak of the peak surcharge be a 1 hour rather than a 90-minute period. So that's one thought. And again, you might make the rate instead of 20 cents, maybe you'd make it 25 cents, but it would apply for that narrower time. And the second thought is, do we have our overall peak period set right, or you know, should it be going to 9:30 perhaps? You know, how early should it be starting later in the morning? Something like that. I mean, it's just adjusting it to, because we have a pattern here that we can see in the chart, and doesn't quite look like the curve we have matches the way we bracket it.
That's true. I think if we tighten it to say a 1 hour, I think we're going to achieve more of our demand management goals. We're going to target it more when the crowding is great, and we'll actually shift more people probably to the shoulder. So, I think the plus would be better for addressing crowding. The negative would be less revenue generated. So.
But if you adjust the rate, so then perhaps you could generate a comparable amount of revenue, yep, but achieve more of your other goal. Okay.
I have a question, but is there another question? When we're measuring that demand, how does it correlate with the services that feed into the rail system from other areas? That is, how broad are the choices there so that we are capturing those folks that can make the change? And I think that's one of the things that, if you're on the outside of the system, it becomes a choice of, well, I'm forced and I'm going to be dependent upon having to choose the higher rate, where you're looking to help us choose to spread my demand across the system as well as reduce the congestion. And the question is whether the feeder services that provide us, considering there are others that are not only in a rail system and bus system that we are all feeding.
Yeah, I think we'd want to particularly look at the service provided in the shoulders of the peak to make sure, both from our perspective, we are providing enough service so that if riders shift to the shoulder, we can handle it. But then, as you point out, looking at systems, local operators that feed our system to make sure that they would be able to handle the increased demand as well.
Mr. Litton.
I'm very interested in how accurate and sensitive our model here is, because you do have, to some degree, I wouldn't say competing forces, but you have the desire here to flatten out the peak, but that also has a major impact on revenues. And you could, in fact, generate the kind of behavioral changes you want in moving people from the peak, but that could have an impact in having a budget gap. So being able to monitor those and how closely that your model is going to be pretty interesting to see this, since we've never done it before. Yet we're building our castle on that sand. So it'd be interesting to see how this works out.
Okay. All right. Are there any other questions?
One other point?
Yeah.
Another issue with this, I think, concerns the max fare question. And it seems to me, and if I interpret correctly what, you know, the way this is presented in the material, the max fare is not affected by the peak of the peak surcharge the way this is presented. And it seems to me that to properly work, the maximum fare has to go by the amount of the whatever the peak of peak surcharge you choose, has to go up by that amount. Otherwise, you're going to have a perverse result, because, you know, it'll effectively not apply to some people and apply to others, and the, you know, the distance differential between people at the very end and people just inside, that'll change. Anyway, it just seems to me you have to shift max fare by whatever the peak of the peak surcharge is.
And that was,
I think that was requested last time. I requested it.
I'm sorry.
That also. I think at our last meeting I requested that the peak of the peak be applied to the max fare as well.
Right.
Do these numbers reflect that?
They do.
They do.
Mr. Graham.
What about the question that Mr. Zimmerman raises? Because once we see this this chart on page 33, it really does raise questions about how we have defined peak of the peak, and whether it's the right definition, whether we shouldn't move. It's a little bit hard to read, but I assume that, correct me if I'm wrong, that the bar after 6 p.m. is actually slightly higher than at 6 p.m. And so, and is higher than at any other time other than the peak of the peak. So, I mean, what opportunity do we have now for revising all of this?
Okay, well, the proposal that we looked at 739 was in the public docket, so that was a starting point. The one thing in general on peaking, you're correct that the period immediately after 6 p.m. is just slightly higher than the period right before it. One thing to keep in mind, this is a system-level chart. The system has peaking at various times depending on what station you get on. So for many of our end-of-line stations, when parking fills up, that's when the peak ends. What we did, though, the fairest thing to look at was when the peak occurs at the maximum load points on the system, and that's what this is generated by. So, and again, we thought that charging when you enter the system was more fair than when you exit, although ideally what we're really looking at is people that exit in the morning close to downtown are much closer to the max load point. What we wanted to avoid was a situation where, because of a delay on a train, someone got on the system when they thought they'd get there safely. However, because of a delay, they ended up in the peak window. So it seems like people have much more control over when they enter the system, and that's when they should be charged. But the peak period should be based primarily on when that maximum load happens.
Right. But do you remember my question? It's a very good response, and it has a lot of interesting information.
Do you have any
ideas? But I asked, what is the flexibility that we now have in terms of visiting the redefinition of all of this, and what's the answer to that?
Can I recognize Ms. O'Keefe, because I didn't see her hand up.
Madam Chair, what was taken out of the public hearing was the up to 50% surcharge for feet-to-feet, but the time frame was 7:30 to 9 a.m. and 4:30 to 6 p.m.
So we can't go outside.
Monday through Friday. Well, if we did, we would be varying from the public hearing.
Okay.
But if we can narrow it, that would be...
Yes, it can narrow, but it can't go beyond it.
But you can't extend it.
And let Mr. Harrington finish the answer here, if he has
I think we answered the question, or was there more?
Mr. Graham had a question as to about where we're going, and the question probably is not one for staff. It's the decision for us as to whether or not we can move this. And I think your response is that the analysis has been done, and that was what we asked. And so we can.
But we could narrow.
That's right. Ms. O'Keefe has given us the window of the legal advertisement. Mr. Harrington has given us the analysis of the options, additional and even beyond. Mr. Downey?
Just following up on Mr. Linton's comment about the model behavior, we don't have a fixed universe of riders. And in fact, one potential outcome, if we can spread current peak riders into the shoulders, we can pick up more people during the peak.
That's true.
That's the idea.
Mr. McKay? Just a question kind of along those lines. Are there any, and this may be a question for Mr. Kubicek, are there any service ramifications of doing this? Are we going to be running, true six-minute headways and peak of the peak? Are there any service changes that riders will experience on the trains if we go to this fare structure?
What they've been discussing, we're comfortable with and implementing with the current schedules that we have. Again, with us looking at it on the red line to add a little bit of headway, but increase our performance will help offset that. My focus, I would say, at this point in time is as you look to narrow it and you spread it out, it's a very interesting concept and it could work. I would say looking at our overall ridership, the evening time would be the area that we would be sensitive to. The morning time is pretty clear cut, but since we do have a lot more activities in the evening, quality of life events and stuff, that would be an area that we would be sensitive to.
Just help clarify that. What I gather in discussing this with staff is that in the AM peak period, there's enough service to accommodate, I'm looking at him to confirm, accommodate some shift out of the peak of the peak into the shoulders of the peak, if you will. The concern, I understand, is in the PM peak, if you were to go later, that would then have a service impact. The amount of service being provided might not be able to easily accommodate people being shifted even later than is proposed here. The way it's proposed here, it's within the service capability, the existing service schedules that we run today, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's fine. Thank you.
All right. Yes, Mr.
Could you remind me again what the gap is that we're wrestling with here at this point? We have how much do we have in service reductions on the table?
We've eliminated the
been passed out reflects.
So if I look on the sheet that I just passed out, the total all the way on the right, where it says total.
Can I ask
5.9? That's correct.
Mr. Graham, may I just point out, and I think it's answering your point because I think the two charts then kind of follow, and maybe she can walk us through them, and that way you'll see
the
what
ridership and finance.
Yeah,
are you
fares.
Are you on page 39?
Well, he's finishing up on 41. Where he shows us the ridership piece, and I think we see that, and that there are questions there.
But I was on 39.
All right, I
you're not on 39.
We could be on 39, yes. We can be on 39.
Well, I just wanted to, before we leave 39, if you don't mind, because there are revenue, I think Mr. Downey pointed this out. There are revenue projections for each of the four options.
Right.
I mean, it seems to me we've got revenue objectives, but we also have policy objectives. And some of these options fit policy better than revenue. Some fit revenue but don't fit policy very well. I mean, it's complex once you look at it closer.
Exactly right.
But I just wanted, before getting too complex, I just wanted to get a sense of the gap. And so we have a gap of how much? Just tell me. We've got 5.9 million in service reductions.
That's correct,
right?
And what is the gap at the present time with everything we have?
Well, if you look, this is this number here.
You're asking for the gap.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have to go to the fare table. Page in your package. I'm sorry. Before we, do they have this in the okay. So let me just clarify. In order to answer your question, we're going back to the last presentation that we provided, because I want to go to the published document so that we're clear. And if we go to that last presentation, I know you do not have it in front of you. We had a gap closing table recommendation. And under there, we had additional jurisdiction subsidy at $26 million, if you recall, in total. Given the fact that now we are had made some of the recommendations today, for your consideration that we just laid out, the removal of the parking, the $4 flat fare, and those things, we've recalculated that. And based upon that, the gap would be $7.3 million that we would have to close. The general manager's recommendation had a zero gap, but because we took out consideration for parking and the other direction, we now have a $7.3 million gap.
I had a 6.9.
6.9?
And that's with a peak 20 cents.
Right. I think the difference there is the fact that we had to revise our projection on the 10 cent additional peak of the peak charge. We had originally said it was 5 million. On further analysis, it's 4.5 million, and that's the difference. Is that clear? Is that any questions?
So we have a. Just to recap, just so I stay clear,
yeah.
Is we have about $7 million in gap.
That's correct.
And we have about $6 million still on the table in service reductions.
That's correct.
I just wanted, I thought it was useful to have those numbers.
Okay. All right.
They're smaller.
Okay. You
want to
complete
moving on. I think we just had two other slides to go
43
through.
43 and 44.
Yes, thank you.
There were two other items that the committee requested information on. One was bus peak of the peak, and the assumptions here were a bit more simple than what was applied to the rail. The analysis here reflects a 10 and a 20 cent surcharge for all bus trips during 7:30 and 9 and 4:30 and 6. And the revenue generated is what's indicated here, 1.2 and 2.2 million. One of the reasons it's so far, the amounts are so far much less rather than the rail, is that rail trips are concentrated during those peak periods, as you saw on the previous slide, and the bus ridership is much more spread out. So that's the analysis here. And then the second one.
And the policy issues are completely different. They're completely different between bus peak of the peak and rail peak of the peak. Equipment issues are different. You know, I mean, I can't let that go. As a parallel, because they're not parallel. They're entirely
the issues. The ridership is different. The ridership peaks are not as severe as on the rail. The capacity issues aren't the same.
And it's easier to buy a new bus.
True.
Than redesign gallery place.
This,
The next proposal that the board, I'm sorry, that the committee asked us to look into was increasing the differential on the use of cash on buses. Currently, we charge a 10% differential for the use of cash. It's actually remarkable. The use of cash on bus is down to 15% of total trips. So it's probably a little bit more than that when you consider that some of those trips represent transfers, but it's still a remarkable. I mean, it's a huge reversal over the last couple of years when we started encouraging customers to use Smart Trip. And that's, again, one of the reasons that this number is so low. A surcharge at 25 cents rather than a dime would only generate about $1.5 million in the first year, and I think that most customers would run out and get a Smart Trip card, so that number would diminish in future years, but that's our best estimate right now.
So that's a really good policy objective.
Yeah, it has the policy effect.
That's what it means. Exactly.
And because we are not measuring the overall efficiency. We would see the overall efficiency. And
right. Madam Chair.
We would derive from that, yes.
Yeah, on these last two points, I appreciate mm-hmm. the staff's response to the questions. I think, you know, my own view is that probably peak of the peak charge on bus does not make sense. Some of the reasons Mr. Graham cited, I think there are several others, too. We probably don't want to do that. I think the differential on bus, however, the cash differential does make sense if we do it this way. I don't think it actually makes sense to keep the way we've had it, because I don't think a dime is enough to be worth the trouble. But I think the 25-cent difference would have several advantages. One, apparently it does have the policy effect that we want, and that's good. It saves everybody money, and it moves people on and off buses faster, which is good. Yeah. Also, the number happens to give you a round number, because then we'd have a 175 fare, and frankly, the cash fare, we ought to try to keep to round numbers. It's easier for everybody, and it means it's easier for everybody, because it's not only the person who's fumbling to find the quarters, but it's everybody that's held up waiting to get on and off. So I do think that this would probably be a good idea.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, let me take some exception to that, because I could not support this unless I had better information on who would be impacted, because I just have an intuitive reaction that I think that what we might be impacting are the poorest of the poor, in terms of those people who haven't taken the time to get a Smart Trip card, people who aren't thinking about that, haven't gotten one from one of the agencies or whatever, and just are using cash, and that's another hit on those who are least able to pay. So I'm not saying, I don't know that to be true, but I'd like to know that. I'd like to have more information so we know what we're doing here before we were to do it.
Madam Chairman, I did fail to say one thing on that, which if I could just, that's a good point Mr. Graham raises. And I should have said, I'm also assuming with this that we would be continuing previous policy by which, number one, we would distribute free Smart Trip fare cards to the very kind of people that Mr. Graham's concerned about. So I'm assuming we would do that at a minimum. Obviously, we would want some additional information. I would also say that I continue to believe that we should reduce what we charge for Smart Trip cards, but that's another matter.
I'd like to have a report back as to how we are with that distribution through the human service groups.
We have
two of Smart Trip.
We can do that. We provided an update actually recently in a board memo, but we can certainly bring it back to communicate how much we've distributed to those social service agencies and how much they have distributed to their public.
And because one of the pieces,
and the plans for next year.
Yeah, one of the pieces that we've removed the options so that it actually makes it easier if we get the cards in people's hands to replenish when they need replenishment, versus it was much harder with the tokens and all of the other pieces that are.
Just comment on, I don't believe that was necessarily responsive to Mr. Graham's request. I believe your request was, of the people who pay cash fares, what is the income distribution, which is different from how many of the smart cards have we gotten out to agencies that then distribute them for free.
I agree totally, and we would, just by practice, do a Title VI analysis on any committee direction that we provide, and that just goes without saying, but yes, you're correct.
But I would note that in past discussions of this, one of the things we've always discovered is that the lower the income, the more careful people seem to be about their commute trip. And those are the people who do the careful analysis on passes and make sure that they get the best deal. And those are the people who go out and, you know, when you increase the fee at all on Smart Trip, they go out and get the Smart Trip, even if they have to pay for it, much less if they can get it for free from an agency. Uh-huh. So that has been the result of our past surveys. I don't know where we are today.
Madam Chair? Ms. O'Keefe had a comment regarding, I think, where we were from a public legal requirement.
I did have a comment, but I'm sorry. I need to look at the published hearing docket again. I had a question about what I thought my comment was going to be.
Okay, Ms. Hewlett?
Yeah, the fact that we're down to only 15% is very, very telling, and in terms of people paying cash. But if this is in tandem with our continued efforts to get the word out, I mean, not just the cards to the respective agencies, but even to get the word out by several means, so that more and more people will get the cards, the smart cards. I think that would probably address Mr. Graham's question. I mean, it doesn't answer his immediate question in terms of who those people are that are affected, but it would help bring those people back and reduce that percentage even more.
Can I respond? You know, but I think, again, you know, it relates back to points that have been made by various of us, that you've got policy, you've got revenue considerations. The policy considerations here don't jive with the buses. You know, it's not, we don't have the level of congestion, we don't have the infrastructure issues, you know, it's, and you have other reasons. You know, I don't think we have, so this is really a revenue generator, and more than it is a policy implementer.
May I offer?
What?
Chris made a distinction between peak of the peak and the differential for use of smart.
No, I'm talking about. I'm still talking about peak of the peak.
Right, and I think Chris was focused on the
right.
Use of
smart differential. Right, right. No, no. I understand. I understand the point. But can we in terms of the cash fare, can we get a cash fare percentage of the riders on a couple of routes? Like maybe that's the way to get at this. Where is Carol? Did she leave?
We can.
Oh, Matt, can you get us this information, say, for the 50s or the 90s routes?
Sure.
And that would give us an idea of what we're talking about.
We can provide that.
But can we agree that we're not going to proceed on this until we have better information?
I think we could. I will leave that as a question if we'd like to put it on the table of how this committee would move. I think we have been in continuous mode of providing information, and I think we'll continue to do that. I think my guidance would be that we at least make some effort to move forward, and what we have to make changes to, if that's going to be the consensus for adoption, then we will do that. But I think you have to move forward with something. That's a personal view, and the committee will guide us on what the committee's view will be.
Well, that's going to take me off this entirely. You know, I'm very uneasy with these increases relating to the bus riders. And, you know, I've generally been against increases in bus fares for all the reasons that I've stated previously. We have data in terms of the fact that people who ride the buses generally are more transit dependent, less able to pay than the people who ride rail. I'm just very concerned about this. And this is the first that this is even being presented to us. And so I'd be much more comfortable taking this off the table. We can come back to it once we have the information so that we know what we're doing. But it's up to you. I mean, I think we're still left with the issue of whether we want to act on just fares anyway.
I think I'd also like to ask for information, and it isn't necessarily for this, but I really would like to hear what we can do in terms of trying to determine throughput. We may not be able to determine it throughout on a system. For example, if you chose a bus route and all of its interconnecting rail routes, and what is the actual fare that the actual user pays? Because I think that's one of the larger pieces that we have to think about. The assumption is that only people who have difficulties financially use buses. Everybody has difficulties, and the way our region is built, it is built that in order for people to get from residence to jobs, they make many, many connecting trips. And so Mr. Graham, I want to be cognizant of what the overall impact is on the rider, and that rider being across all demographics. And the bottom line to that is how we best serve the region from an economic standpoint and from a quality of life of how people need to move through the system. So we may not be in agreement about the particular pieces here, but I think we're trying to keep to the same basic fundamental piece. We just may be looking at different modes of operation or modes of travel for people. But
speaking of that, let me suggest that we keep something in mind. Because as this bus fare goes up to 150, 160, 175, we still have in the District of Columbia the DC circulator, which is operating at $1. And you know, this is a major dilemma for us all, and I don't have the immediate answer to it. But as Metrobus goes up and circulator stays where it is, you know, there's definitely going to be impacts. I mean, there was always a 25-cent difference. But the higher the differential, there's going to be impacts on the DC circulator. We're going to lose revenues. We're not going to achieve any objective in terms of additional revenues on those routes where we have the DC circulator, which is some of the, you know, which parallels some of our most traveled routes in the District of Columbia. And people are just going to go to the circulator. And then what are we going to do? The circulator will be overwhelmed. We'll be off in our revenue projections. It's just another thought for you to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. Ms. Carroll, we can complete this, and then I think we do need to have discussion regarding decision.
So basically, the last chart.
The last chart.
And I think we're discussing that currently is some of the guidance that the committee can give us, either to explore other alternatives, and I think we actually have a couple of questions that Mr. Graham, Mr. Zinnerman, and some of you have posed, which I would like to, I've actually asked staff to get that information now.
Okay.
To the extent we are not, you know, convened, we can actually try to provide it. And to the extent we can't get it in time, we'll provide it in a board memo, and then hopefully have it for the next discussion.
Okay. All right. Then the last item here is this was shared at the gap closing sheet was shared as an overall folding in what the proposals that came in on the fares into the overall budget. And the sheet was generated to provide as much guidance to committee members as to how we could refer the fare piece and what the impact would be on subsidy or the gap, as my might recall it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And this, they're going to pull up the chart right now for everyone to see. But just two quick notes. This includes assumption of 20-cent peak of the peak applied to all riders. So it's the first option that we discussed. It does not include Mr. Graham's request about the max fare. Increasing the max fare from 11 to 15% would generate about $800,000. So that would be the change to this sheet.
All right. Is there a recommendation or a question? Mr. Graham.
Yeah, this takes us back then. Mr. Downey, if my memory serves me, you weren't able to attend.
I was not at the last meeting.
But we discussed exhaustively the point that you raised earlier, which is why can't we have a system put into place, you know, working out all the technological details, and then we wouldn't go to a bake sale as an option, but we would say, here's the number to fit into the system, into the technology. And I still, Madam Chair, quite respectfully, I still don't understand why we can't proceed in that fashion, so that we can have the final decision be part and parcel of our full budget consideration. I mean, just as a matter of the ability of the staff to technically do this, I still don't understand why we can't do it that way. So you could put in a hypothetical number of 1,000. I'm just making this up. And then we come back to it and we say, no, it's not going to be 1,000. It's going to be 500. Why can't that be done?
May I go ahead and respond as to why they can.
We can go through it again, and I apologize. Maybe I haven't been as articulate, and I thought we were the last time. We are taking our legacy system that is 40 years old and making it into a new upgrade. And we're doing that in tandem with the fare increase that we're looking to implement for the first time in a few years. So my staff and Dave Kubitschek's staff recommendation was that they needed a 60-day window to actually technically develop that. And it's not as easy as putting a number in there, as you suggest, from what we are understanding. They need actually time, and we actually laid out that time frame at the last meeting. Frankly, I do agree with you that we should be doing this as a whole, comprehensive, and that's typically how budgets are done. But the fact, and we would accommodate the committee when the committee, let me be clear about this, if they say, well, we're going to make a change and it's at the ninth hour, of course we will actually take that direction and then modify the team that's actually implementing the fare tables and the systems. Definitely, I want to make clear we will do that. There will be some impact to that, but I'll communicate what
right,
that is.
But let me just one follow-up, please. Please, Mr. Dunn. If you can make those changes the way you have suggested you can, should we change course, then I don't. It doesn't follow for me. You're not able to put in another number. It doesn't follow for me that you couldn't put in a hypothetical to begin with and then establish what the real number is.
It increases the risk of actually getting it right July 1, which is a very high ridership weekend. It increases that risk that we would not actually get that revenue starting the fiscal year. We would actually start the fiscal year maybe with a potential hole because we would not have the ability to implement the revenue, the fare increase. It just increases the risk. That's really all I'm laying out for you. It would cost more to implement potentially, but it's the revenue loss that I'm very concerned about. And that's what I've communicated.
Mr. Downey.
I mean, I'm looking at the fare proposals that are in here. Simply raising the Metro Rail fare is something that's been done very, very frequently. Not a big deal. Same thing with the buses.
I'm sorry, I cannot hear
Same
you.
Thing with the buses. Same thing with reserve parking fee. These are all kind of no-brainers. Yeah. I think the one that would be most troubling is peak of the peak. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be helpful, if I were in your shoes, to say, of those four options that are on the table, is there a preference in order that we could move forward on that? I still would say, if you move forward on how to do it, you could set the amount at a later date. But I think there is a necessity on that one to say which one of those options makes sense.
Mr. Linton.
Only thing I will say to that in the defense of the staff, having a client that just went through a fare system conversion with another agency, there was a high level of concern about the ability of the TVMs and all the equipment within the system to be fail-safe in time to deal with the changes in those systems. And the risk factor increases the shorter the time window is for the work to get done. The client was very concerned about raising fares and on top of that having major screw-ups imposed upon people who are going in to the fare system. And they recognized that when you shorten the window of giving the time of, because it's not only just installing, but it's also testing. You have to test all those devices as well to make sure that they've been properly been installed. Mm-hmm. So it can be done, but as been stated, your risk factor increases significantly.
I thank you for saying it better than I have, but I will add that it's all of the customer interfacing within the network that we actually have to derive. I mean, and it sounds simple, but the signage, it is extremely important. We have signs everywhere on vending machines, on mezzanines, you know, pamphlets, all those things. Those things are on a 103-mile network. Those are things that take time. Regional buses, how it impacts, you know, the feeder systems. Those are things that actually take a long and considerate amount of time to complete and develop and make sure it's right to our customers. And that's also a factor.
Ms. Kissel, you did articulate it very well before, actually, so, and it's just been further enhanced by Mr. Linton. It is a problem. We've been discussing this for the past two meetings now, and the fact of the matter is the further removed the further along this goes, the tighter it is, and the more difficult it is for our staff. And it's a balancing act. I understand what you're saying about looking at everything in totality, and that's the way, ideally, that's the way we should do it. On the other hand, we have these exigencies where it's got to get done. I think we're at that point now where something has to happen, so you're balancing these two competing priorities. And I think that, you know, that's why I think this discussion today is really good, and I think maybe we can get there. I'm hopeful that, you know, with a little bit more discussion, maybe we can get there.
Mr. Zimmerman?
I wanted to go back to Mr. Downey's point, which I think was to try and frame the guidance that the staff really needs from the committee or the board.
What they need
and when they need it, right. So, I mean, I think his point was that some of these things, they're not simple. They don't sound simple. They aren't simple. But we've done them before. They know how to do them. Other things are more complex because it's a new thing. Some things are simpler just because they're simpler, and some things are more complex because they're more complex. So while the staff would no doubt like to know exactly where the board is going to be and what we're going to do on all of this, and that would make life easier, the fact that we're having this conversation now and not 2 months ago or even a month ago means that we're not going to have that. So can you define the set of things which the committee might in fact be able to make a hard recommendation on, a narrower group? For instance, if the most complex thing, the one that is the most difficult and the most uncertainty surrounds, has to do with the question of peak of the peak, I can see where it might be useful, and I thought this was where Mr. Downey was going, for the staff to know that the board is, number one, committed to the idea that we're going to try and to do this in the coming fiscal year. Number two, that we've got a pretty good idea of how much we want to charge for that. And number three, that we know how we want to define what that peak of the peak period is. And I thought we had a pretty good discussion about that. And if it would be useful for them to have that nailed down, even before they know all the other things, then perhaps you could give more meaningful guidance than you can today on the question of whether or not there's going to be a cash differential on bus, which might be something still, or what the parking charge increase will be, 0.50 cents or something in between, on which there clearly is no consensus, or what's going to happen to the charge on bike lockers, which we haven't discussed either, but also probably should get some adjustment. Would it be useful for the staff to know that specific piece of information about peak of the peak, and is it possible there is a recommendation that could be made today?
Okay. Is there an action for the board, for the committee at this time?
Let me ask that question. I mean, would it be sufficient if we had a guidance on peak of the peak? Recognizing that you'd like it all, I'd like to adopt a budget.
Resoundingly, yes. If we got some type of direction, we would be happy with that.
If you got some kind of direction, you'd be happy with that?
Well, let me paraphrase it. Yes, if the committee can give... Well, let me say exactly what I mean. Yes, we would love to get the direction of the committee so that we can, as specific as the committee can get.
No, would it be enough if we gave you the peak of the peak guidance in terms of the technology and the testing and all of the other issues that have been...
Yes, made? It would be.
Ms. Kessel, can we put this on the overhead so that, I guess I'm not dating myself overhead, but so that we could all see this at least for purposes of discussion?
Oh, I'm sorry. We switched over to the schedule on the implementation of affairs, but we can switch back to the other.
Switch back.
If you like.
Okay, it's up, Ms. Kessel.
Can I actually clarify, and Jim actually don't you, yeah, sit back down. Because Jim actually is our point person for actually coordinating the implementation of the new fare tariff and all the parties involved in this. And what he's stating, and I'll let him speak, but basically the direction of the committee, we would like the direction of the committee to be what the actual max fares are going to be for rail and bus, the way we've laid it out on this fare table, because it gives us the ability and time to actually make all the changes based upon all of our tiers. And I think that the peak of the peak, we have a little bit more time, because as I've indicated before, we would not implement that until August 1st. So as a result, we have a couple of weeks that we can actually have time, if you will, to make that decision. But the maximum fare tables, and what we've recommended, that is the clear direction that we would like from the committee. And I thought I had that actually the last 2 weeks. So I just want to clarify that's still in
you
place.
You really did.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Can you scroll down a little bit?
I'm looking at all these. There are a number of things on there I'm sure that are worth discussion. I just wanted to look at the additional, the jurisdictional subsidy then.
Yeah, we'll see. And let me clarify on these, Ms. Hewlett.
Too far. Move back up. Okay.
And let me clarify, because when we look at these are based upon where we are now, the estimates.
Right.
So if the committee decides to change services, obviously these allocations are going to change. So what this assumption is where we are now on the recommended bus and rail service changes. Based upon that, that is the estimate that we're looking at here. I just want to make sure that's clear.
Right. There could be additional changes based on final modal allocations. This is our best estimate right now of the jurisdictional subsidy. Just wanted to make sure.
And I'm sure there are questions here. I may have some myself on some of those. But for the jurisdictional subsidy, then, for DC, it would be 14.5
additional.
A million additional. Yeah, and then mm-hmm. for Maryland, 16.7, and Virginia is 2.2.
Okay. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And that's just if we went with that everything above the line. Okay.
That's correct.
All right.
Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
Can you scroll back up a little bit? Okay. All right. Thank you. I just wanted to look at some of those things. Okay.
Well, do you have a Ms. Hewlett? Are you?
Yeah. I may come back. I may have a couple other questions.
Okay. So we have in front of us the budget. That's the essence of what I had indicated to us, that we have a budget. And what we have as an uncertainty amongst the things in this budget that needs to move forward would be the fare increase. And we could put the budget as it sits here today with the options that are given on the table as a proposed budget for us for approval. And then we could make the adjustments that are needed. And if they are not where we want to be, we can change them. Is that the point?
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes.
So just for clarity, Madam Chair.
Yes.
This chart, the changes that are in this chart that are proposed, mm-hmm. would give you sufficient guidance to continue moving forward towards an implementation in the most seamless manner possible to our customers. Does this give you enough guidance, or would you need something beyond this? In other words, if we put this chart on the table from this committee to keep this process moving forward with the understanding that items within this chart can be changed at any point in time, does this chart itself give you enough guidance for your implementation of any of the changes that are on this in a comfortable manner?
I would answer this way. It definitely gives me enough guidance for a framework to develop a budget. However, I would make the point that I don't believe it includes some of the districts' comments that were made today. I just want to note that. We have to go back and do some other analysis on those requests.
Right, we understand that.
Okay.
We understand that.
Yeah, but there's something else that's going on. You want to go?
No, go ahead.
Yeah. There's something, and that's why it's important to keep track of what happens from one meeting to the next. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a suggestion that we take off the 50 cents on the parking. My recollection is that has a price tag of about $6.5 million.
That's correct.
I indicated, well, I was willing to see what could be done to cover that. But rather than having that on the table now, we've just simply taken it off, which, for example, means an additional burden to the District of Columbia of $2.5 million over what we had discussed 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. See, we're not prepared to just take it off. Let me finish, may I? And that's what happened between the cup and the lip here, you know. And what we've got to go back to do here is to say, okay, we can consider, and this is what my position was previously, we can consider taking it off, provided that there is revenue sufficient from somewhere else to cover it. That did not include simply the District of Columbia paying more. And that's, you know, that's where we're ending up. And I know that the peak of the peak increases that we contemplate, that we discussed, actually we just mentioned them, we didn't have any agreement, did not, upon analysis, raise enough money. So I got all of that. But see, I gotta move us back a square or two here. Because this chart is assuming something that we are not agreeing to, which is simply saying, okay, the subsidies are gonna increase in order to remove the 50-cent charge on parking. That's not where we are.
Actually, it's also to remove the expense on closing, opening up to 3 a.m.
Right, but that had already been resolved.
No. In the same manner as the parking was resolved, we thought.
It's amazing what we call resolution and discussion.
Okay,
it was the same discussion. I can understand where we are.
Well, this will grind us to a halt real fast. And because, you know, here's my committee report. Let me show you. It's here in draft. It was circulated late last night, which has an additional payment to Metro WMATA. Mr. Albert, you know all about this, of $12 million to close the budget gap. It does not have $14.5 million in it. So this is the reality of what I'm dealing with. And it was never suggested that we would increase subsidies in order to not have an increase in the fees on parking. That's what I'm suggesting.
Mr. Graham,
we have a problem.
You can look at that as putting a 7 point or whatever the number is, 6.9 or 7.1 next to the 33 subsidy. It just says that the budget isn't closed. And I think that is we started with a $40 million unclosed piece, and we have moved through iterations. And we have moved through iterations trying to figure out what, one, is good for our customers, two, what we as a jurisdiction could provide, and how to compromise over what we all wish we could or could not do. And that's, to me, the only way to get there. But gauntlets won't get us there. And
what happened to the 15% increase on the max fare? How much money would that raise?
It's $800,000 estimate.
And we took off the flat fee as a result of the concern and put in the peak. And that changes greatly the revenue piece. And so Ms. McKay had a question. I don't know if you wanted to go there. Ms. Hewley, go ahead.
Well, you know, every now and then I find myself in agreement with Mr. Graham, so don't go too far. And I understand the issue about the parking and that $6.5 million. And, Madam Chair, I'm willing to actually go forward with a motion on this, at least for purposes of discussion, so we can get to some of these issues, because they may not be – none of them are etched in stone. They were all direction that were given, and you did exactly what we asked you to do. You came back with the information and what it would look like given those four, five, or six items that we gave you. So I'm ready to go ahead and move at least this top part up to the total, the part that's enclosed as a budget.
Is that a
motion?
Fare increase? Or are you going to do the services as well?
I was doing the whole thing.
Second.
Fare and service.
Yeah, I just at least want to get on the table for purposes of discussion. Okay.
Questions?
Ms. Hewlett has moved, and Mr. McKay has seconded.
Question on the motion.
Okay. Yes, I can go to Mr. Zimmerman
just to
for
clarify
now.
What the motion is.
Mm-hmm.
I understand then the motion is essentially the staff table.
Right.
With all that. So, in other words, it includes the fare increase proposal as it was presented when we walked in the room today,
yes.
Not reflecting any of the discussion that's been had this morning.
That's correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's for purposes of discussion, so we can, I think there are things in here that need to be tweaked, but I think something has to be out on the table.
Thank you.
Well, if I had a vote in this committee, I would now move that we substitute the results of the discussion on FAIR that you had for the past hour and a half with what is in here, but I don't, so I won't.
Can I make a clarification?
There are a couple of things, the one-hour peak of the peak, the 25 cent.
Sorry, let me just make a clarification. The what's in this table here includes the 20 cents for peak of the peak.
Yes,
but
the
substitute.
Periods,
yes.
And not what we were discussing.
That's
earlier.
Correct.
So that's
and
right.
I actually, if that that's were a friendly amendment, I actually think that was a good idea, actually.
But we have one of the peak of the peak options would raise $7 to $10 million.
The 50 cents?
One of the four options would raise, as our
yeah, but that was
two and through.
Well, we haven't decided, unless I'm missing something, we haven't decided on which peak of the peak approach we wish to take. There were four options presented.
Page 39.
The fourth, thank you very much, Madam Chair. The fourth option, as I remember, would raise $7 to $10 million. My memory is serving.
That's correct. It's the two and through.
But that has some difficulties.
Well,
that's a good point.
Staff
it, iterated. It's 10 cents already is in the baseline.
That's right.
So there would be a set off on that.
Right.
But there, depending, I'm just making the point that we need to discuss which of the four peak of the peak options we wish to pick, one of which has much higher revenue than the others.
Well, I thank Ms. Hewlett for putting this on the table, and that is exactly where we could go if we want to make adjustments there so that we can move forward with at least something the staff can begin with. And we are not adopting a budget, but we're putting a budget forward. Okay. Mr. Benjamin.
Since we have a motion on the table, it seems to me that it might be worthwhile to say, okay, given that motion, are there specific changes or additional directions that we do want to make? And it seems reasonable for us to clarify which one of the options and at which dollar or penny level, really, we're talking about relative to peak of the peak, and it seems to me if we are talking about adjusting the size of the peak, whether we also want to adjust the amount. And I believe the other item that we spend a fair amount of time on is there a policy reason, because there really is no finance reason, for increasing the size of the differential on bus or smart trip use to be equal to rail? And I would suggest that we just clarify those three items and then move forward with this as it's been moved and see where we are so that we know that that is in fact what we're voting on. The first one the presumption was that we were doing option two on peak of the peak.
Right.
And very honestly, my position on peak of the peak is the others are very attractive from a philosophical point of view and a planning point of view. I find them really interesting, and as a former planner, I would be fascinated to see exactly what would happen. But at this point, I don't believe there's another transit. Well, there are very few transit systems in the United States that even have time-sensitive fares,
right.
Much less time and distance. And I don't believe anybody has tried peak of the peak fares in this country, and I'm not sure anybody has anywhere else. I sure would like to know a lot more about it and be able to have our customers understand what we're doing if we move in that direction before we get into the complexities of it. Depends on which station you get off. So my bias would be very, or go through on your way to another station, which really gets complex. Seems to me we need to know more about it. I understand that the staff is making estimates based upon lack of data. I mean, we basically don't know very much about this. It'd be nice to learn it. It'd be nice to introduce it if we are going to do so in the simplest possible fashion so that our customers can understand it and can work out their travel based on it. So I would go with option two and do that quite strongly.
Mm-hmm. If that's an amendment you're moving, I would second it.
Well, I think it's a clarification.
I think it's in the chart. Is that?
It's the one that's in the chart.
It's in the chart. It's in the chart.
Option two. Clarification of that.
All we have is that's there. Okay. All right. Yes, Mr. Downey.
At 20 cents.
Okay.
At 20 cents.
Sarah, are there any other recommendations that for changes?
Where is it in the chart? Can you just show me where
the line?
If you look at the beginning line under fair increase proposal, the 66.9 reflects the adjustments that have been made, and within that.
Where
is the peak? Yes, fair increase proposals, metro fair. Okay, and that was the analysis staff came back with. Yes.
Right, and the 66.9 on that line matches what's on page 44 of the revised fare table for the rail fare, 66.9 in both cases.
Yes, Mr.
And if there were a decision to narrow the hour range, the amount would have to go up in order to retain the 6.9.
In order for it to be revenue neutral, that's correct.
So any change should be revenue neutral if we're going to know where we are relative to the whole.
Okay.
No,
this is just that is just a clarification of what's already there.
Mr. Zimmerman.
Okay, so. What you now have is essentially what you had, which is it's the 20 cents. It's the whole 90-minute period from 7:30 to 9.
As the first step.
That's where you are. Right. So you have the question of whether you want to change that period, whether you want to change the rate, and you have the question of the max fare adjustment for peak of the peak fare.
Well, I think the max fare, they already clarified that the max fare adjustment for peak of the peak was in there. Because I had requested that last time.
No, let me clarify. It's not in there, but it would average
peak of the peak
for the after midnight. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, the question is whatever the peak of the peak surcharge you wind up including, you need to have an adjustment to max fare.
It's in addition to the max fare, and your answer to that was yes, that's in these numbers.
That's correct.
So that's already there.
So you're assuming that all along, or because it didn't show with what we walked in here today?
It's in this chart.
She produced the chart after
okay, so it's in the motion.
Yes, it is in the motion.
Part of the motion.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other adjustments that we should have? Mr. Albert.
Thank you, Ms. Hodgins. I, too, don't have a vote on this committee.
I know you don't. We let people talk.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak. So the one thing that I'm actually surprised about, and maybe I didn't do my homework well enough and read the documents, was the proposed increase in the jurisdictional subsidies. So we have been working, we the executive and the Fenty administration have been working with the legislative branch on a particular number, $12.6 million. $12 million, a $2 million increase or any increase obviously goes through a significant amount of additional vetting within the District of Columbia government. So I'm hoping that my colleague, Jim Graham, wouldn't agree in committee today to that additional subsidy and give us an opportunity to work within the district to see if that's at all feasible.
Sorry, and then tell me the point where you'd like to be with Mr. Graham.
I like your choice of words. What I'm simply saying is that we're not prepared to support at this point in time the increase in the jurisdictional subsidy from the $12 million that was on the table at the last meeting.
Okay. Mr.
Just so there's no misinterpretation, for Maryland, we originally were at $9 million when our budget was finally closed. We completed our budget process. Since then, the number went up to 14. Now it's up to 16.6 or 7, depending which table you look at. And we are not making a similar statement. We will, in fact, cover that increase.
Wonderful.
That's good to know.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Right, exactly.
So we have okay. What we're trying to accomplish here is to give guidance as to what the fare increase will be in this budget. And I think it's been clear that we are likely to make some adjustments in that, and that those adjustments then will reflect the overall budget as it is stated here, which means both preventive maintenance and subsidies to be affected. And I think we have not discussed that because it's taken so much to have a fair. And I would like to say what I consider the fair, because while we have indicated the difficulty of arriving at a fair adjustment, I think the level of adjustment is important to our customers. And I think of it as the part that we do with the subsidy. We go out to our jurisdictions to find the revenue that's provided, and we need to be very clear as to how we get there and whether or not we can. And I think the same is important in terms of where the fair revenue should come from. It is larger than probably any of us want it to be, but you cannot be supportive of fair increases and no reductions or vice versa and think you can close this budget. All of them are going to be part of it in some way based upon the conversations that we are having around the jurisdiction. So comprehensive piece. Mr. Downey?
Yeah, I'm just following up on that. It seems to me if we reach this decision that this table is the working document, any discussion henceforth about change should be accompanied with a pay-for.
With a what?
With a pay-for. Mm-hmm. In other words, not just come in and say, I don't want to do service or I don't want to do fares. It would have to be, I don't want to do it, and here's how we would pay for it.
I'm paying for it or whatever else. Yes.
Now, I think you need to quibble.
Okay. Mr. Zimmerman, and then I'll come back to you, Mr. Graham.
Madam Chairman, in every conversation we've had throughout the months that we've been doing this, I've always had the pay for, and mm-hmm. I've put the money on the table, yep. too. And I'm sorry that we seem to still have unwillingness on the other side of the river to do what the Virginia jurisdictions have committed to do on taking some more load off the customers with what is really a small amount of jurisdictional subsidy, frankly, relative to our budgets. But if that's where we are, that's where we are. I would say, however, though, that to send forward to the committee with the constraint you just put on it, the budget in the form you now have it, which, as I understand, you've taken the parking fee off the table. It's not in there. But you have the biggest fare increase that anyone's ever seen, and you still have reductions in Metro Rail and Metro Bus service. I do not have a vote in this committee, but I can tell you right now, I would not vote to send forward a budget that has the largest fare increase that anyone's ever seen and yet still cuts bus and rail service. I think that is a mistake, and I think you should not be telling the public that that's what you think you're going to pass in June. I would recommend before you have taken this vote that you take one more look at this. I mean, there are a lot of ways you can cut something like this, but one obvious one is if the parking fee went back to where it was, you could take away all the service cuts. Now, that's not the only way to do it, and there might be some other way to compromise, but, you know, what you did the last time, frankly, was to, as soon as people on the committee started talking about they didn't like this or that, things got dropped. So the after midnight issue was settled as far as Mr. Graham was concerned, and the parking issue was settled as far as my good friend from Springfield was concerned, but you know, those were ad hoc decisions, and now you're getting kind of locked in, and I don't know that you, Mr. Hill, if I could just finish, I don't know that you want to do that, and so I'd say before you take this vote, think about whether you got a little more refinement, and I would urge you to consider just about anything that takes those reductions off the table before you send this very large fare increase forward.
Ms. Hewlett?
Thank you for listening.
Mr. Zimmerman, what I was trying to none of those decisions were made. They were direction given at the last meeting. None of those decisions were made. That is why I made this motion, so we could put these items on the table for purposes of discussion. I'm going to take exception to your comments about across the river not putting more money in for Maryland. We do this. We have put in an awful lot. We're willing to go ahead with the $16.7 million increased subsidy, which is more than the $2.2 from Virginia and the 14.5 from D.C. You have said this over and over and over again. You're beating a dead horse. If your horse is dead, dismount. Okay. Now, having said that, I agree with you on the issue of the fare increases and the parking And my issue there is I'd like to put this on the table about putting the parking back in. Because I do think that would help with reduce the fare increases, and I think that is good. I can support you very much on that, and I'd also like, and I think that's six, Ms. Kissel, is that 6.5 million, I think?
For parking?
Yes.
6.7.
Well, thereabouts.
Yes, six, that's correct.
6.5?
For 50 cents.
6.5, I'm sorry.
Okay, for the 50 cent, if we put the 50 cent increase back in. And my next issue is, and I'd also like to know, what if we go back to looking at the District of Columbia instead of the peak after midnight, if we went back to that flat fee, it would be, I think it was 2.3, if the flat fee was 2.25 million, and
the flat fare after midnight was 2.3.
Yeah, the flat.
Charging the peak fare on late nights after.
Is 0.8.
Is 800,000.
800,000.
Okay. Is a gain of 0.8.
No. Is a gain of 0.8 minus. Okay. So if we put. I'd like to know if everyone's feeling on that. If we put those back in, can we do something else then for the in terms of the reduction of the fare increase?
Oh, what would that look like if we do what you're suggesting?
I don't know. That's.
You pick up 6.5 million from the parking.
Uh-huh.
And how much would be the gain from charging $4 fare after midnight?
2.3 million.
Would be the gain.
Oh,
no,
I'm sorry.
Not
no,
the gain.
No. The gain? Yeah, I'm sorry.
So it's 1.5, right?
Yeah.
1.5.
Right. Okay. Mr. McKay. I will not support that at all. And anyone in this room who thinks that a parking increase is not a fare increase isn't paying attention. It's a fare increase. It's a fare increase. We talked about the largest fare increase we've ever considered. $67 million fare increase on the rail. And now you want to increase that number even more by increasing the parking. I will not support that. Certainly, $6.5 million is not an insignificant number. It was never presumed going into this. It was given guidance at the last meeting that it not be included. And I'm not soliciting additional laughter by saying it was settled. As others have said, other pieces of this have been settled. I don't think it's settled. I'm fine with the discussion of it, but I would highly suggest that we take another look at whether or not that's a fare increase. It's absolutely a fare increase, and it's a fare increase on the people who are most fundamentally impacted by this budget already. These rail increases are for our riders who are going the longest distance. Let's not kid ourselves. And then we're going to add on top of that a parking increase when our parking garages aren't even full. When we're trying to get people into our system, and now we want to raise the parking fee an additional 50 cents. I will not support it under any circumstance at all. I think it is profiling a certain rider. It is not given any thought of this being a regional system. And frankly, it to me, it's an unacceptable addition to put back in, and I just am not going to support it. And I would suggest, as we had an earlier conversation today, that people were talking about the impacts of the bus fare increases. Perhaps it's time to pull out a chart and ask WMATA to pull out the chart that shows what the subsidy is for a bus ride versus the subsidy for a rail ride, so that we can get a refresher reminder on what the region subsidizes the bus ridership for versus the rail ridership. I am a big proponent of busing. There is no doubt about that. But at a certain point in time, and I remember a certain general manager who just recently left here who said, to get Metro back on track, we need to take a serious look at the jurisdictional subsidies and the subsidies that we give to people who are riding buses. And if we're going to talk about raising parking again, then let's talk about raising bus fares even further, because it is crippling this agency, the subsidy amount, and something has to be done about it. This is a transportation authority, not a charity. And if we're going to keep going out to the suburban areas and saying we're just going to jack up the parking even further, take more from you, and increase the rail fares even further for the long-distance riders, you're going to lose those riders, and then there will be no bus service. So I take personal exception to the idea of raising the parking rate.
Maybe there's a middle ground here.
Mr. Grant.
Maybe there's a middle ground. And that maybe we can get a reduction of the 6.5 million,
by having either increases in the parking rate at those lots which fill early, where there might be some policy considerations we can make, or we could do it 25 cents. So the way it is right now, it's 6.5 million. The combined total, the net total of the late night service, which the district is interested in, even though it serves the entire region, these are riders from Fairfax and everything else that are benefiting from late night service, is 3.6 million. So 3.6 million versus 6.5 million. This was very much on my mind at the last meeting when I said, whoa, wait a minute. This is, you know, I know what a good deal is and what a good deal isn't. And so if there's maybe a way to compromise the parking, we might be able to get there. But to take it off the table in its entirety is equally unacceptable to us. So, you know, we're not going to move very far here.
I think we're at a point of trying to figure out what's good for the authority. And when we look at what's good for the authority,
oh, yes,
and that is the customers that we serve. And so I think the points that have been made are points that are made in terms of how we are willing to make adjustments here that will get us to a budget and, most importantly, get us to the item we want to do today to solidify our positions on where the fare increase model can go and we move forward. There are lots of things in here that are difficult for us to accept. While we will be passing or moving forward on a budget that has the largest fare increase, we will also be moving forward with a budget that has a built-in deficit for 2012 at $30 million. And I don't know who you will go to next year to begin to fill that one, with no projections of knowing where we might go. So as we think about this, I would hope that if you are intending to solidify positions today, that we don't lose sight of the entire piece of this, because that is a critical part there. We got here because we made projections last year that were not consistent, and we had a bad economy. I would usually say that knowing something that you've done wrong, you don't need to continue doing it wrong. And there is a basic principle about trying to balance a budget. You are not, it's not magical. It sometimes is flawed. But you can start with the right intentions. And I think the intention should be to identify those areas that don't start putting us in a deficit to begin with. All of these items are difficult for us to buy. Some take more exception with it than others. I think what we've done here is, and Mr. Graham, I appreciate your opportunity to try and move forward in both the late night closing and understanding what the parking means to us. And I think you've articulated that. The question is, what portion of parking do we think that is appropriate for us to take? And I think Mr. McKay has been very clear about the rider's expense is a fare, and the fare begins the time you park your car in the parking garage and get out at the rail station or any other place. So I think we have to think about where that is. I think maybe we should stop here and we can come back, which gives us an opportunity to adopt something that is acceptable to all of us. There's utter silence here.
Well, I just think this is an equitable solution, mm-hmm. the one that's on the table right now. And the max fare is the 15%. Increase to 15% has got to be added, because we're doing a 36% increase on the bus pass. In this proposal, 36%. And I know of no reason why the maximum fare should not go to a 15% increase. That would produce $800,000. Are you sure of that?
Yes, we're positive.
Okay. Well, I don't know where we are on motions or anything else, but I think that's got to be part of this.
Let me comment on the max fare, if I may.
Yes, Mr. Benjamin.
Let me note that although I'm not quite as strong as Mr. McKay on the rail fare item, I was trying very hard to move in the direction, Mr. Graham, if you may. I was trying to move very far in the direction of what was appropriate relative to the max fare by saying that the max fare should be increased by the peak of the peak, which moves it actually pretty close to a 15% increase over the base. Just so that we do this in broad context, keep in mind that last time we raised fares, a couple years ago, we raised rail fares, boarding fares, over 40%. We raised parking over 50%. We raised bus zero. So you have to look at this over a period of time. If you put the two together, I mean, this is now starting to come to the point where rail is much, much closer to bus, but is still a larger increase by quite a bit than buses. So it's important for us to look at this in that kind of broad context. And if we took what we've got today, the person who was riding the longest distance on the rail system would be paying 90% or more of the cost of his or her ride and would be paying, let's see, we've got a maximum of $5, $10 plus in Montgomery County, 4 1/4. So they'd be paying $14.25 round trip for one ride. That's probably the highest of any rail transit system in the United States.
Yep.
That's an incredibly high fare, whereas bus would be $1.50. So, and that is only 36% of the cost of that trip. So if we're talking about equity, I think, in fact, the rail fare has gone up pretty substantially. Parking has gone up enormously recently. And we need to see some moderation there. And certainly the max fare, by including the peak of the peak in there, I think pretty much accommodates the issue that you're raising.
We have a motion on the table.
What is the motion? It's been seconded.
The motion is to adopt the piece that the budget that has been presented here with the adjustment. Did you get a second to your team?
Yes.
Yes, I second.
And the flat fee, the midnight flat fee, and what was your second one?
Your motion is to take off, is to keep the 50-cent increase in part.
No.
The original motion did not include that.
The original motion is just
this chart.
It's this chart.
I thought
it's the
you
table.
Made an amendment.
No,
I never got accepted.
No,
nope, we didn't.
No, I put it on the tape. We were in discussion. There's been no formal amendment, no, including the 1 hour, 25 cents for the buses. There's been no amendment. So if everyone wants to make one,
right.
I put that out on the table. I put that out for discussion. This is, we were trying to reach some sort of consensus to address the issue. Parking. I tried to
well,
see about
are you
about
going
the
to make an amendment? Or are you
I
not?
I'm, somebody else should make an amendment to my motion.
Well, but it was your concept. You typically the person who has the concept makes.
So
the
I
amendment.
Make an amendment to my own motion.
We made this.
Sure.
We put the $4 back in. Did we put the $4 flat fee back in?
Well.
Why don't we keep it simple and stick with your motion?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, I you know I.
Because otherwise your motion is going to fail.
Okay, my discussion addressed two additional issues, which I'm sensing was the parking, which I think Virginia's not going to go along with, and the $4 flat fee, which I don't know if DC would go along with.
We're not crazy about it.
I know, but
we're not as opposed as Virginia.
And then that helps. Well, can I so I don't know that it's that if I put those in there, it would pass, but I can put the flat fee in there. I'll put it in.
And the 50 cent increase.
And the 50 no.
It will not pass.
Oh, just the flat fee?
He's doing that on a trade.
Maybe we might.
I don't think that's going to fly.
Maybe we'll want a second on it, and then we'll know it's in.
I seconded already the original motion. The original motion.
So it's, this is the original motion that's been seconded.
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. We've added two things to here. Let's not lose sight of the peak is in. We didn't do the flat fee.
No.
I can make an amendment and put them both in there and see where it goes.
So why did you make it?
I don't want to make the amendment. I think we're better off with where you started.
Yes.
Okay. I think it's about time to call for a vote.
All the questions.
Well, I have a further comment because, and I reluctantly say this, but I think with all due respect to our chairman, everybody takes a turn in being chairman of this board. I had a year. I've done it twice. You're doing it this year. And we defer to the chairman in terms of the committee structure. But I think we're at a point right now where the flawed nature of this process becomes very apparent to me. And I've got to say this, because this board operates on a with a lot of jurisdictional respect insofar as the fact that one jurisdiction can impact the final decision even when there's a majority vote for that decision. But here we are in this committee about to take a very important step and actually make a decision, which I don't think we can do, by the way, because without board approval and without the operation of the voting members of this board having a say about what's going to happen here. And I'm being told now that we're going to go forward with the fare increase, which, you know, is but one element of the budget. It is not, has not been subject to a board vote where we have our the procedures which are guaranteed to us by the compact. And I think this, it's apparent to me right now this is a flawed process. And I don't know without, and I would ask you, Mr. Benjamin, before anything is done, I would call upon you to convene a special meeting of the board to review this so-called guidance before any action is taken so that we can have our full process occur and not have this go forward as some kind of a formal decision when, in fact, it isn't a decision. It should be subject to board review and to the protections and procedures that we have in the compact.
And okay, so, may I comment, please?
I think I'd rather comment.
Okay.
And you could take responsibility as board chair. Mm-hmm. Then, no, this is a committee, and I don't have your history on here, but the committee does have the right to adopt something and move it to the board. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're doing, moving it to the board. And
so if that's all it is, it has no import beyond that?
It is no different than any other action that comes out of a committee. It goes to the board for adoption. And if it's not, and it has options for iterations before it comes to that board. So it is a way to change it, and it is a way to leave it as it is. And I started that way. I'm not going to talk about what kind of structure we're under. We're under a structure that best we are at this time, and I think we should make the best of it. I have tried to communicate and allow everyone to participate as a board, and I communicated that very clearly last night. But that's where we are. But we're trying to move a piece that will at least get us moving in this item. And I think some of the discussions we've had have been very good. It's the first time we've had it as thoroughly as we had today. But I think it will get us moving with still some disagreement. Mr. Benjamin.
Actually, Mr. Graham, you raised an issue that I was going to ask a question about and may have gotten an answer from the committee chair. There are, and one of the things that's happened is all of us, or many of us, have gotten telephone calls from the media about what is the board going to adopt today. And the answer that I have given over and over and over again is the board is not going to adopt anything. The board cannot adopt anything because the only thing that's happening today is a committee meeting. Therefore, nothing will be adopted here in terms of a fare increase. The question I was going to ask is there are, in fact, two options for this committee relative to this motion, and the motion itself was not clear on that. One is it can be an indication as to where this committee is relative to the staff in the same way as it did the last time, 2 weeks ago, saying this is where we are so far in the development of what we're doing, or it can be a recommendation from the committee to the board. If it's the former, it doesn't have to go to the board, but the staff has got to be pretty aware of the fact that there are differences of opinion and that whatever is here may or may not ever pass the board. If it is a recommendation to the board, then the board has every opportunity, and all the board members have every opportunity, to change any element of this or the whole thing. And, in fact, no decision whatsoever is made here other than to recommend something to the board. So the clarification I thought I heard from the committee chair, and I guess both the maker of the motion and the seconder would have to agree with that recommendation, is that this is a recommendation to the board, which the board can then accept or dispose of in any way it wishes 2 weeks from now.
Agreed.
And is that what your intent is?
Yes.
It's absolutely my intent.
Right.
Okay.
May I just want, that's very helpful, actually, very helpful indeed. So that we don't have, the word that's been tossed about here is guidance. There is no guidance here today. It is simply a recommendation to the board. And we can put aside all that language, committee direction, and all the words that I see in these documents should be very carefully put aside. And I am, however, concerned, as are we all, that we take full advantage of the opportunities to have the revenues that we need. And so that's why I suggested that on this issue alone, we could very well have a special board meeting to consider it. I think the way this is being presented, though, this creates, and if I'm out of place, you'll just simply tell me. But this creates a problem for the two voting members from the District of Columbia. And so I hope that between now and the board meeting, we can continue to work on this so that we can find an accord, because this is not it. And I'm going to vote against this today, and it would be my intention to vote against it at the board level. But I am willing to continue to work to see what we can come up with.
All right. Is there a motion? The motion that is standing on the table. Are we ready to vote?
Yes.
Okay. All those in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No. And I'd like to be recorded as voting no.
Mr. Graham is recorded as voted. Is there? All right. Thank you.
Is that right?
The next item is the capital agreement.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
There was a request from the District of Columbia to put on this agenda an opportunity for the District of Columbia to purchase streetcars.
Right. Yes.
And this is a very time-sensitive issue, and it does not in any way compromise this board because it's fully reimbursable.
Mr. Graham, I
don't know what happened to that request. I know I spoke to you, and I know
yes,
others have.
Yes, and I think I spoke to staff. I spoke to Mr. Albert, and I spoke to staff. And I would like to know if you would like to make a motion that we put it on the agenda for subject to approval at the board, but asking staff to provide the information because it's a new item and we don't, the time that it came, we didn't have information that could be provided and didn't know how it would be addressed. But understanding it's a District of Columbia item and you would like to have it forward, I think you should move forward that you should have a motion that would say that we place it on the board agenda and then that staff will provide us all of the guidance that we need, speaking with the District of Columbia. For the 27th.
So moved.
Okay.
Could I restate that as referral to the board without recommendation for the committee?
That's exactly right. No recommendations are there that you wanted on the board.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay. Is that a consensus without a vote? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Okay. The next item.
The next item is the capital funding agreement. The purpose for this item, actually, today is to gain board endorsement of the for staff to actually distribute the multi-year draft agreement in order to negotiate that among the jurisdictions and to agree to the framework that the multi-year agreement contains. And that's the purpose. Given we've had several presentations on this in the past, so this is a very short presentation, it actually just communicates that where we are currently is we have a flexible six-year agreement with funding commitments up to the $5 billion level, which is what we had proposed in the January budget. We have showed various levels of that over the last several weeks, and what I'm saying to you now is I believe we have commitment to a $5 billion six-year agreement. Given that assumption, we will program the capital budget for that level, and we have already. We're making some minor changes to that currently. The advantages and disadvantages and some of the concerns that we have, I'll briefly just describe here. The advantages, of course, is the fact that we have the commitment to fund Metro, which is an obvious advantage with having a six-year agreement succeeding this next agreement that's expiring at the end of the month, at the end of June. The other advantage, the way the agreement is being developed, is it will be allow the jurisdictions to pay on an expenditure basis. Over the last, actually since inception of Metro, we have always received quarterly payments from our funding partners in advance. The request of the jurisdictions is to actually fund those payments on an expenditure level basis. So that agreement will reflect that request. We are looking to constrain our contracting and financing costs. This multi-year agreement and commitment will be able to engage us to do that, and we'll have all of the projects, if you will, and the capital program under one roof, which provides for a much better oversight and management and accountability. And, of course, the increase to Metro capital funding, which reflects the increased match that the jurisdictions are providing regarding the what we're calling the dedicated fund, but I think actually it's now PREA, which is a Passenger Rail Investment Act, and we will refer to that in the future as that. So that increased funding is also included in this six-year commitment. The disadvantages are the expenditures, if expenditures actually exceed what some of those forecasts are, we'll have to manage through that. As we work with the jurisdictions, we'll have to now set up another billing structure that reflects the cash basis billing that the jurisdictions would like. So we'd be working on that, but it could cause some uncertainties relative to how the jurisdictions appropriate. We'll work through that with the negotiations on the jurisdictions. Some of the issues that you see on the other column talk about the line of credit. Cost of purchasing a line of credit could be increased if we actually don't prepare a forecast and bill appropriately during the year. So we'll have to actually manage through that. And again, I think the major issue and the difference here is that we would have to set up a new billing arrangement with the jurisdictions. Currently, we don't do that. We're not set up for that, but I'm committed to that. And part of the financial systems integration program that you saw earlier in this committee, it is actually going to help us do some of that work. So. The next page and the subsequent pages after that, there was a request from a board member that wanted us to look at the existing Metro Matters agreement and compare it to what the new framework is going to be. And I won't go through this in detail, but let me hit the highlights, and I'll address any questions that you have. So on the first page, the next capital funding agreement will be more of an annual agreement with an annual review with an option to cancel every 6 years. They'll also be looking at debt service that continues into the agreement even if the agreement is canceled. So the commitment on debt will continue on throughout the life of that commitment. That's a benefit. On the next capital funding agreement, and we have already started this process, we have described the capital projects in detail Every project reflects our, has a CIP number. It reflects our capital net needs inventory that Nat Boddinghammer and his team have put together. It has a page for, you know, what describes the scope of work. It'll have a page for the milestones. It'll have information on force account labor. It'll have those types of project management things that our funding partners are requesting. That's the accountability and the oversight. That's a benefit to this agreement. On the next page, the commitment to match all the federal grants annually is going to be a very big benefit as well. And that amounts to the system performance funds that have been in the past provided by the local jurisdictions, in addition to the federal formula match, in addition to the match under the Passenger Rail Investment Act. And actually, I think what was distributed today, there was a letter that was sent to Richard Sarles from the FTA administrator, which actually reflects that comment. I don't know if you wanted to say anything about that, Rich, but I think we distributed that letter to the board, and it's really just a commitment that the jurisdictions continue their maintenance of effort funding, and this capital agreement will reflect that. Okay. The next page, some of the new nuances of a new capital agreement will be, again, we'll have new projects in the annual work plan, and we'll have, once again, which we haven't had before, sources and uses of funds. We will make the attempt to look at sources of funds and earmark them to specific projects. We have different colors of money. We have federal formula grants. We now have passenger rail investment grants. We have possibly some discretionary grants in the future. We have obviously the local system performance funds. Because we have different colors of money, in the past we have used that as those are fungible, so they were not interchangeable. What we're looking for now, the jurisdictions has requested accountability. We will be earmarking those specific funds to specific projects. So one project can have three sources of funds, and on the reporting process, we'll be showing that on a regular basis. So that's a difference as well. On the next page, again, the subsidy formulas, the dedicated funding resources will use dedicated funding provisions. A few weeks ago, we actually sent a letter to the FTA administrator, which defined what projects we would spend our passenger rail investment monies on for their approval. So we will continue to do that in the future as a request from the FTA to make sure that those projects are eligible beforehand so that we can actually program on an annual basis. And then the last comment I'll make on the annual work plan context, I've actually already reiterated that we would actually look at projects by CIP, by element, and we would look at sources of funds as we budget our program. The appropriation commitment is the last chart, I believe, on that, or maybe not. We actually will look at the term reasonable efforts relative to appropriation and make an attempt to understand each jurisdiction's appropriation process, and hopefully we can reflect that appropriation process in the multi-year agreement, which was not done in the prior agreement, or not done as explicitly as I think we need to have it in this particular agreement. And then the final difference is the annual reconciliation process. On an annual basis, we will reconcile our projects to our funds, what we spent, what we budgeted, what is lapsing, what is rolling over, and we'll be providing that to the jurisdictions, our funding partners, and to the board. And I keep thinking about the last chart, but I'm not. But reprogramming. We have never, not as much defined the reprogramming process as clearly as it may have been, could be refined, and lessons learned on any process, we have determined that we will have a more formalized process on how to reprogram projects that engages our funding partners and actually presents that information to our funding partners prior to actually presenting that to the board. So we can have some consensus within our funding partners for the board's consideration. So that's another change as well. As far as, so that's the concept of the framework for the agreement. And I know we haven't actually, the JCC has been very intricately involved in the actual draft of the agreement. I know the board members haven't actually seen the agreement yet, but what I'm asking for here on this action item is for the board or the committee to agree to the framework that I've laid out here so that we can actually continue on the negotiations with our funding partners to address some of these issues that we've highlighted here.
So we're looking for an endorsement and sending it out to the jurisdictions as a whole to continue those negotiations to return to us for adoption.
That's correct, yes.
Mr. Benjamin.
And I would note that I just want to make sure that we are in fact approving what you said right now as opposed to what this document says, because what you said expanded somewhat and modified somewhat the words in that presentation. I have no problem at all with what you said. I very much agree with it, and I very much support it. There are a couple of places in there where you were a little bit broader in your statements, and I appreciate those. So when we're saying the principles, are we saying what you said or what's here?
I will say, I'll try to clarify, and I think I know the point, and you can correct me if I haven't said this. Yeah, the next capital funding agreement will include the concept of billing on an expenditure basis, which is what I've heard that the jurisdictions would want. That is different than what we have done before.
With regular updates based upon what the past activity has been and the projected activity is going to be.
Yes.
So the invoicing will happen.
And it's similar to what we do on the federal government. I mean, we apply for grants. The grants are approved. The federal government approves the program, if you will, eligible program. And then when we expend those monies, we actually draw down on them. We submit a bill to the FTA, and then they actually pay in 3 days. So I'm not sure, you know, that concept is the same concept that I hear that the jurisdictions would want on the way we actually bill the jurisdictions.
So that's your explanation of that principle, which is fine.
That's
like
my
explanation.
Of the principle, that's correct.
The other one was the legislative efforts, and I think I've commented to the general manager that there's a you correctly said that you really have to tailor that to each jurisdiction. The statement that's in here, if applied in the state of Maryland, would have a perverse effect that could, in fact, harm the authority, which I don't ever want to have happen.
Yes.
So as long as it's the interpretation that you gave of, you know, yes, it's got to be tailored by the jurisdiction, I'm fine. The statement here is a little bit too tight and creates a problem.
Well, and the reason why I made the statement about tailoring it to the jurisdictions, to our funding partners, is because I'm relying on our general counsel, actually, as well as to analyze under our compact from a legal matter, you know, what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. I can't opine on that right now. What I can commit to is that we should work with our funding partners to find out, you know, how we can define that. Might be, and I believe it is different among the jurisdictions. So we have to try to reconcile that to make it work for an agreement that all parties can sign.
And again, if what we are proving here is what you're saying as opposed to the words in this document, I'm fine.
Can we change the words to reflect what I'm saying?
That's fine.
That would be
very
good. Request that we see a document that, in fact, reflects what we're approving.
Okay. Between now and when it goes to the board.
We can do that.
Is this going to the board?
This is going out to the jurisdictions.
So this
this actually is an action item?
It is an action item.
But
so
is it an action item for a recommendation to this? Gets back to Mr. Graham.
I think we will have the same endorsement to go out to the jurisdictions on the 27th.
Yes, specifically
right.
The action
27th
item
is the action of the board. This is the committee
those
again.
Those revisions, as Mr. Downey noted, could be made between now and when it does, in fact, go to the board. I would have greatly appreciated.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Mr. Downey.
Yeah, I had several questions.
Yes, please.
One at a time. First off, to note, because I missed the point the first time around, that this is, in fact, a $5 billion capital program. And that's a piece of good news. It's not as good as it could be, but it's certainly better than where we were. I would hope that relatively quickly we would get sources and uses for the $5 billion. For the moment, I'll assume it was what was in the January budget, but I'm sure there are some changes. But the sooner we can see that, the better. Secondly, and my earlier comment that we would like to see this revised to fully reflect what's been agreed to. On the question of reimbursement for expenditures made, which is the practice with the federal government and is at least suggested here as the practice with the other jurisdictions.
Not quite. We're saying we're willing to advance the funds. But
you're willing to advance
estimates.
What I would like to see is the cash flow kind of process you will have for cash flow projection, mm-hmm. for the ability to pay those bills when the bills are due, right. and then whatever the adjustment would be. Mm-hmm. But you're saying you don't want to advance money unless there's a reasonable prospect.
Correct.
That it's going to be expended.
Yeah, we don't want yeah. to do what the feds do, which right. is reimburse.
So it's not totally reimbursement. That's fine.
We would advance it.
Right. And we need to know how, since we'll be managing much more tightly, how the capital forecasts are being done and what happens if there's a need to have the money to pay the bills.
Can I comment on that before you?
Yeah.
Because you're exactly right. And this is a very... And let me be clear, this is a very different
yeah.
structure that now I am inheriting. So 40 years, you know, we'd write the check and it would sit there, and I hear that, you know, we're flush with funds because we're not spending them. So I hear what you're saying, and I am actually already started down that track to try to figure out what I need to do to change the infrastructure to accommodate for this concept. As well as, and I know Dave and I have been talking a lot about moving the money out as quickly as possible. So the goal that we're having is to try to increase our spending for next year. And those things are happening among staff. We're speaking with our general manager to talk through that. And we will be presenting that to the board separately, as well as baking it into the agreement that we have here.
So we take IOU that early in the fiscal year we'll see a process, an explanation of how the new management process
That's exactly
is intended
right.
to work. Because I don't want to be 4 years from now saying this isn't what we thought it was going to be, because I think that's been part of the problem in the last few months. I think there needs to be a pretty good degree of clarity here. I think it can be worked through. I've even got some suggestions as to how you can speed up processes, but we can touch that.
I believe I have my yep. marching orders,
right.
so
yep.
it will not be 4 years Good. From now.
On the slide with respect to funding for annual work plan projects, mm-hmm. The first bullet that talks about, in effect, a rebaselining of unallocated, and I think it should have said unexpended funds. Maybe I'm misreading
yeah.
it. No, it's funding for annual work projects. Keep backing up.
On annual work plan contents? Or
yeah.
No. Oh, I'm sorry. Look at the wrong one.
It's page 51.
Yeah, I see it.
Page 51.
And the issue is on under the new capital agreement?
Yeah, the first bullet which says
right.
all unallocated and expended funds. I assume you mean unexpended?
It really should say unexpended,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah, and then secondly, with this reshuffle at the end of a fiscal year, I would point we will need to retain the integrity of PREA funds
mm-hmm.
and the match for PREA funds. That has to be met for however long it takes to do that. On the issue of reasonable efforts and action by legislative body,
mm-hmm.
Again, I'd like to see at the appropriate time what that definition is. I'm familiar with agreements between a public authority and a governor that says the governor will, in fact, request the money in the budget.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, it cannot constrain a legislature, which can't have an opportunity to, in effect, diminish what can be provided by not asking for it. So I just want to be sure I understand that.
And I think that's a
yeah.
common among
yeah.
the jurisdictions.
Yeah.
I think
and
it becomes...
It will vary by jurisdiction.
That's part of our problem.
But we've got to figure out that we, again, know what's feasible, what isn't feasible. Then lastly, in terms of representing this to the board, I would like to see a slide on the provisions with respect to default.
Okay.
And how those either will continue what's been in place before or change it appropriately. But I think we need to understand that as well.
Okay.
That's it.
Mr. Zimmerman.
Good addition. You're taking general comments on this?
Yes.
Okay.
And Ms. Kissel is, unless there is objection from anyone, we wish to include those so that it goes out.
Yeah. Madam Chairman, I think
as an overall framework, this is a valid approach that can move us forward to where we need to be when we have a long way to go. I agree with Mr. Downey that, you know, there's an improved prospect here compared to where we were a week or two ago. But apart from, you know, the structure and the framework of what's in here, and the second question of what goes, what's coming, what's being paid for, what the expenditure list is that goes with us, what the priorities are, which, you know, I think we still need to get that presented in a way that's easier for people to understand the nature of the choices. We talked about that last time. The third part of it is the actual amount of money that's in there. And Mr. Downey described it as a $5 billion plan, which is better than we were. And that is true. But I want you to look at what actually is in here and what isn't here. One thing that I don't particularly like about the way this is presented, and I raised this the last time, and I thought there was agreement that it was going to be shown a little differently, that I would ask for in the future. We need to separate out what is the extension of a jurisdictional agreement for capital funding from the new earmarked funds that are coming as a result of, you know, particular federal legislation and the associated state match. When you actually look at that, this $5 billion program goes down by about $2 billion or $1.8 billion because $1.8 billion is the new money. So what we really have in here with the way the numbers are set now is approximately $3.2 billion of a commitment from the region extending what we have been calling Metro Matters for this 6 years, going forward another 6 years. Now, if you compare that with what we have had under Metro Matters, you can argue that it's a maintenance of commitment. It's close enough you could probably make the argument with a straight face, which wasn't necessarily the case 2 weeks ago. The initial Metro Matters agreement was a little over $3 billion, so this is nominally larger, although it's 6 years in the future rather than 6 years in the past, and if you look at, you know, any kind of modest estimate of inflation, to merely do what we did under Metro Matters, we probably need about $3.4 billion. So it's actually a slightly smaller commitment from the region going forward. Now, keep in mind that that was already inadequate, that our outlook within the 10-year time framework was we were $3 billion short. This is 6 years, so it can get a little confusing, but you know, within the 10-year time frame, we were about $3 billion short, so within the 6-year time frame, you know, you can scale that down. Again, we need something that crosswalks the capital needs inventory with the timetables involved here and what we're actually looking at funding. We need to be very clear on what parts of that needs inventory are not funded under this plan. And it's a lot because you're short a few billion dollars. I mean, again, it's probably going to be about $3 billion because that's what we were saying if we had that amount of money. And so while I'm glad we've started moving in the right direction and I'm glad we have a framework here that we can move forward, number one is we need to recognize, we need to be clear with everyone, this is an inadequate plan. If we do this, things actually will not work well. This is not really, in the end, good news. It's only good in the very limited sense that we're starting to move back in the right direction. Instead of digging the hole deeper, we may be starting to climb out, but we're still in a very big hole. The second key point is that we have very little time now, you know, because of the impasse that had gone on for so many months. We're only now starting to really talk about this again. And staff is only now really being able to give them the opportunity to work on the specifics with the jurisdictions. And as difficult as all that stuff we did this morning was, and lots of people are out in the hall still all excited about that, this is A, much bigger, B, much more important, and C, has even less time to be figured out. Because we need to not just resolve our FY11 budget that we've been working on this, but now the details of this complex agreement are going to have to be worked out in very large measure within a matter of weeks because the jurisdictions will need to know. To be very specific, my own jurisdiction has to decide on its capital plan in June. I don't know what Fairfax's schedule is, but you know, we have to vote by July to put bond measures on the ballot. And my jurisdiction, like some others, every 2 years puts bonds on the ballot for Metro, which our voters approve and then pay for. That's all related to this plan. So we have to know, you know, in another month what amount we should be planning on. So this means that there have to be very intense, accelerated discussions among all the jurisdictions and WMATA to nail down all the little pieces of this
so that a month from now we can actually agree on something specific, whatever the number is, just so that all the details that go with this general framework actually can be worked out. So I think those are two things that we're going to have to really have people focus on. Number one, the problem with the fact that it isn't enough money. It is deficient. And number two, that the agreement has to be put together and informed to be adopted, at least in its structure, within about a month, if we're going to even be able to, you know, deal with the first biennium.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. I guess we should be reminded that the staffs have been talking continuously, and I think there is a view that many of us work the same way. I approved the referendum to go out, the language for referendum to go out already. We have a Metro Matters agreement that is expiring, and we have noted that, and therefore we recognize the approval process here. But I think what we're saying, what we're doing today, is officially sending this out, sending it to the board to go out to the jurisdictions. And I think it does commit to addressing what we have as the long term of the $11.5 billion needs piece. But I think there's something else that was said by Mrs. Kissel and that's been echoed with everyone that I've spoken with, and that is that we move dollars in order to meet those commitments that are there. And to me, that is going to be the best way to make sure that we bring money to the table, because we will always look back to say, well, the money is sitting there, therefore why should I put it forward? And the fact is you should put it forward because we have a needs that's out there. And I look forward to the commitment to demonstrate how well and how quickly we can do the projects, because that's what gives you the latitude to go back to the jurisdictions to say, this is the commitment that we need. And I understand that we made a very good commitment with Metro Matters, with the jurisdictions saying they would, and they did, fund this. But I think the larger piece is that we have to continue that in a pace that really is going to make a difference to the infrastructure. We still have very difficult challenges ahead of us from an infrastructure piece, and that we have to meet that. And I think we can provide flexibility, but we still have to recognize in providing that flexibility, we are going to be able to keep the authority a whole in the manner in which we're doing this. I think we should, we can move forward. I think with a motion to move this to the board. Do we have a question?
Can I say yes. One other thing? Just a couple things to address. I know Mr. Zimmerman's comments and yours, yes. Mrs. Hudgens. We do have, as you know, in the January budget, a very detailed program that staff has put together that assumed a $5 billion program. And then it assumed in the outer years what we're not doing, as you indicated. The program for the 6 years for $5 billion is primarily a state of good repair. That is the program. It does not include some of the other things I know that you are talking about, and we have talked about in the past, the enhancements. Those have been deferred. They don't go away because of the constraint on the funding. Secondly, I do agree with the timing issue. On the next chart, we actually have the timeline for the jurisdictions. We, as staff, have already programmed to the $5 billion level, have made some of the changes. We make the daily changes regularly. We are providing that to the jurisdictions continually in our discussions with them to get them familiar with the projects. In an attempt to actually move this, because we're cognizant of our funding partners' deadlines and timeframes with which they need to approve, we are also actually sending this out for public comment, which we are required to do under the regional plan. And on the next chart, you'll see, I don't know, Nat can talk to this better than I can, so I'll just flip it over to him, but he can tell you the process for what we're going to do to actually open that up to the public consideration.
I think that the key item here to get federal approval of the funds that we intend to use is actually a hearing that we'll be holding on June 2nd, time to coincide with the Writers Advisory Council. We would post that information on the web. We'd like to have a newspaper notice this weekend, and we think that we'll be able to get public comment in time for the board to make comments at the Finance and Administration Committee in June, prior to the adoption of the capital program. So we'll get comments before we take the action. We'll also get comments before the TPB approves the amendment that we will be bringing
to them. So, I mean, those are really the key points. I guess the other point I wanted to make is on the previous slide, the first item, we'll be looking for a board approval of an agreement for referral for signature to the jurisdictions in 2 weeks' time. We had made a lot of progress in negotiating an agreement through late March, early April. That's been put on hold for a couple of weeks. We'll need to resume that. And so I think if we get a positive vote from the committee this morning, our intent is to go out and have intensive conversations to finish that line-by-line review of an agreement document so that we can bring you a finished document on the 27th. So this is really my assumption. If we get the positive vote, we will be starting negotiations with the committee, with the jurisdictions, in advance of a board vote on the 27th. And I hope everyone understands that.
Okay. Is there a question? No questions. Is there a motion?
So moved.
And is there a second?
Second.
And the motion is that we endorse the capital plan and send it out to the jurisdictions. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Thank you very much. Ms. Kissel, I'm going to ask if we do the next two items in a total of 5 minutes.
I will.
And see if we can
do that. I can do that in 5 minutes. So, plan of contracts. Actually, this is familiar to the committee. It's a plan of contracts on where we intend to go for FY11 in anticipation that the board approves the operating budget as well as the capital budget. And all this presentation does is show you what the operating contracts are. They're about $122 million. We broke them up in a variety of different ways for your view. We have them in detail attached to this presentation. And if you have any questions, I can answer them. But primarily, most of the contracts here on the operating side, if you go to this slide shows all the benefits of why we want to have the approval of the operating plan of contracts. It gives us the ability to do long-range planning and pricing, better pricing on contracts, forward-looking and getting more participation in that. But if you looked at page 70, I believe. It just shows the breakdown of the operating plan of contracts. Most of that is, most of the contracts, 70 of them, if you will, of the 117 are all under 500,000. So they're just really regular contracts that we do in order to keep our operations going, a going concern. So if you go to the capital plan of contracts, this is based upon the program that we have in place currently. The plan of contracts that we're looking for approval from the committee is about $145 million. It does not include the bigger projects, which we intend to come back to the committee and the board separately. Some of those are the major projects, the 1,000 series car replacement, the 7,000 series, the rehabilitation, the DuPont Silver Spring and the bus garage replacement. That's about $300 million worth of contracts. But I know the board would like to have us more presentation, more detail on that, so we'll be coming back separately for those things. The in-house labor is not something that we would come to the committee for. It would just be a matter of approval when the board approves the actual budget for FY11. And then the preventative maintenance is also within the budget approvals that the board would have in June. So the split out there on the plan of contracts just shows that it's about 84 new or modified contracts, and it has a lot of detail in the appendix. We'd be happy to answer any questions between now and when the board approves this on the 27th. I'll be happy to answer any questions you have. So.
Madam Chair.
Any questions, Mr. Benjamin?
I just want to compliment the staff on a really good job. First of all, getting it to us early so we have a chance to really go through it and look at it and have a time to have our staffs review it. And also the level of detail and the care with which you've dealt with many of the issues that we've raised in the past. I mean, you have, in fact, put together a proposal that allows us actually to analyze what you're suggesting and ask you intelligent questions before we have to vote on it. So thank you very much. That was very well done.
Thank you.
Thank you. And the next item is financials for the month.
And this has gotten we've had a lot of press requests on this too, but I'll be brief. Be brief on this, but get to the issue. On the, this is March results, year to date on our operating budget. We're clearly showing a deficit, bottom line, of about $54 million. That deficit is made up of a $40 million deficit on revenue and then about another $15 million on expenditures. We have already communicated to the committee and the board that we have a $40 million mitigation plan to actually mitigate some of that deficit. That mitigation plan you're currently not seeing yet because we have not made those journal entries. We have not come to the board to request for specific use of the reserve. We are waiting for a final approval on the ARRA funds, surplus funds that we would use, and some of the others. So we intend to make those journal ledger adjustments and approvals by the June meeting. So you will see that $54 million go down to the $40 million mitigation plan that we have indicated. The two other things that are driving some of the increases that you had seen that we had not communicated, we are seeing an increase in Metro Access. This year we had assumed that we'd have a $10 million overrun on Metro Access. We are now estimating that it's going to be an additional four on top of that 10. That is a very large increase that we have been seeing and we expect to forecast between now and the end of the year. I know Christian Kent can talk to some of the reasons why that's happening. It has to do with the growing demand for that service and how we're actually providing it and the cost of it. So he is looking at ways to mitigate that for FY11 and renegotiating the contract potentially that we currently have. And I know some of the ways that we proposed to you on how to tampon demand is going to help that for FY11. That's a problem. And as I've communicated before, the snow days that we had in December and more in February have exacerbated that problem as well. I'm still still driving toward the goal that we will be in a deficit position in the range of $15 to $20 million, which I have communicated before. I'm working diligently, and I know we all are, including Dave, on the operations to mitigate that deficit as much as we can. So I'm committed to that. As we look at more internal costs where we're not actually spending those dollars, we're actually moving them into the forecast, and I'll have a better we'll try to make those journal ledger adjustments for you for next month as much as we can so that doesn't look like a large deficit that you see now.
Thank you. Okay.
So the ridership, can we just emphasize?
Ridership, we have and let me say one other thing on ridership. This is the end of March, so we have April, May, and June, the last quarter. If the ridership, meets budget, as we have projected that it will at the end of the year, this would offset some of the deficits that we're seeing now. But I can have Matt talk to where the ridership is year to date.
Sure. And just quickly on rail, again, the news is it's fairly positive as of March. We're down 1% against budget, but year over year, total monthly, we're up by 6%. Average weekday ridership on rail, we're up 2% from the previous year, but down 2% against our aggressive budget. The bus numbers are being adjusted. We had preliminary bus numbers and what's reported in your packet today of about 10 million monthly riders. We have discovered some issues in transmittal of the bus data, and we will need to restate the bus numbers. The good news is that we've actually captured more riders that weren't originally extracted from the systems originally. So the bus ridership number will increase by about 700,000 from what the information you have, and the revenues will also increase. And in addition to looking at that issue in March, we're looking at all of the prior months, the fiscal year, to see if there are comparable adjustments that need to be made, and we'll have more information about that at the next committee meeting.
And that makes a good point. As you know, we recognize revenue, when we actually get it. Because our ridership numbers and the way we recognize revenue, the methodology, we might not be capturing the bus ridership. I've instructed our controller and our budget to look at the whole year and reconciling that. We might be able to restate the way we recognize that revenue, and that's a positive thing that will help offset some of the deficit that we're seeing now. So I'll be ready to communicate something on that hopefully by next month.
Bus ridership still overall is facing a more severe decline than rail. We think that it may be a little bit less severe than we've reported, at least in the current month.
Can I just ask a quick question?
Mr. Benjamin? Yeah.
I just want to clarify, you are still, though, calculating revenue based upon transportation used.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, okay.
And we're at the 3% level. As you know, we're recommending a higher level for next year, but...
But what you're telling me is that you're not getting as accurate figures on transportation used as you originally thought you were, and you're reevaluating that to see if maybe we did, in fact, get more riders and therefore more revenue.
Basically, if the ridership data is below what we should be saying, it actually affects revenue, and we need to make that adjustment on our books to reflect that, and that's what we're looking at. Yes.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mrs. Carroll. Ms. Carroll, if there are no other items, then we are adjourned. Thank you.